Okay, we're going to go ahead and start our meeting. I'd like to welcome you out to the Northern Regional Advisory Council meeting tonight. We'll start with introductions. Over here, Jim Gaskill.
My name is Jim Gaskill. I'm from South Weber, and I represent the public at large.
Paul Cowley. I represent the Forest Service.
Craig Van Tassel from CAMAS Sportsman.
John Leonard, North Ogden, represent Sportsman.
John Wall from Riverdale, public at large.
Joel Ferry from Brigham City, represent agriculture.
Lynn Nelson out of Cache County, elected official.
Bruce Silito, representing Bureau of Land Management.
Bryce Thurgood, Perry, Utah, public at large.
Kristen Purdy from Ogden, non-consumptive.
John Cabot from Hooper, non-consumptive.
And Justin Doling with the Division of Wildlife Resources. I act as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
And I'm Robert Burns. I'm the chairman, and I represent the public at large. Our purpose here tonight is to gather public input on concerning wildlife management policy, rules, and regulations. The council will then make recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board sets policies for all protected wildlife in Utah. If you join me in turning the ringers off on your cell phones, we could have an uninterrupted meeting. Jeffrey, when you get a second, would you introduce yourself?
R. Jeffrey Hicks. I'm represent at large.
When speaking tonight, please be sure to address the microphone. Be sure to come up to the microphone and address it so we can get a clear recording of the meeting, especially the council members, if you'll use your microphones. We can get that. The sound system is a little sensitive tonight, so we can't turn the recording volume up very high. The recording will be available on the internet on the division's webpage, and we will have a written minutes transcribed from the recording. Our procedure tonight will be that we'll have a presentation from the division, then we'll have questions from the public, then we'll have questions from the RAC, then we will go to comments from the public. Please be sure to fill out a blue card if you wish to address the council. If you just want to write some comments on the card and not address the council, please just mark that you would not like to address the council, and I will read your comments into the record. After the public comments, public input ends on the agenda topic. We'll have comments from the RAC, then we'll have motions. We'll deliberate on those motions, and then we'll vote. I'm sure tonight that we will have some diverse public opinion, so please respect other people's opinions. We don't need any applause. And if someone has presented your position and you would just like to support that, if you would indicate that when you come up to the microphone, we could get through the process a little bit faster. When we do have public comment, the vice chair to my left, John Cabot, will be timing you. Groups will get 5 minutes. Individuals will get 3 minutes. So when you come up to the microphone, if you'll state that you're representing a certain group or just yourself, then we'll know how much time to allot to you. When the timer goes off, please wrap up your comments quite quickly, and then we can move on. I won't try to cut you off immediately. So we don't have any real good visual indication that you're running out of time. I would like to also acknowledge Bill Fenimore is here. He is on the Wildlife Board and lives within the Northern Region. Thank you for being here, Bill. With that, we can go to our agenda. Chair would entertain a motion to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting.
I move we approve the agenda for tonight's meeting.
Second.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskill and a second from Paul Cowley to approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. All in favor, would you please say aye and raise your hand?
Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you. I did have one small amendment to the minutes of November 5th from John Blazard, and I will amend the minutes for that. It was specifically, I think he was talking about one unit, but we had a different unit's name in there. Are there any other amendments to the minutes? Jim?
A very minor amendment, but when we were talking about Phragmites last time, we mentioned that they might bail it, and you spell the B-A-I instead of B-A-L.
Thank you. I won't tell you how pilot was spelled many times, so, but we're working on that. So with those two amendments, are there any additional amendments? Seeing none, Chair would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of November 5th, 2014.
I move that we approve the minutes as amended.
Second.
We have a motion from Jim Gaskill and a second from John Leonard to approve the minutes of the November 5th, 2014 Northern Regional Advisory Council meeting as amended. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. We just had our Wildlife Board meeting on Monday for our last round of RAC meetings. So I have not received a summary of motions, so I'll just try to go over them real quick. The Wildlife Board approved the statewide mule deer management plan as presented. They did not add a strategy that a division would study antler shed gathering hunt, antler shed hunting closures. There had just been a study a couple years ago, so they were talking about that. I'll try to get some information on that back to the council. Okay. So on the Bucks, Bulls, and Once in a Lifetime season dates and application timeline and amendments, the board did not change the wording on a mature goat. They felt that it was okay to have that in there, that they were, it was recommending that you kill a mature goat, not specifically that you count the rings on the horns. So they did not include that in their motion. They approved the Bucks, Bulls, Once in a Lifetime season dates and application timeline amendments as presented. They didn't, let's see. I'm trying to read my chicken scratch here. They did include a moose boundary change that was recommended to the other RACs and extended the bighorn sheep season on the Range Creek and 9 Mile units. They included wording to make sure that the extended late muzzleloader tags were excluded from landowner associations. They approved the big game preference point recommendations as presented. Also the CWU management plans and permit numbers, and on the landowner permit numbers, the division and the Pilot Mountain Landowner Association came to an agreement that one tag in 3 years, which was what our motion was acceptable, and that was included in the division's presentation and it passed as presented. And that's it. Are there any questions on the Wildlife Board's actions? Seeing none, we'll go to the regional update.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome everybody out to the Regional Advisory Council meeting this evening. Just a quick brief update. Our law enforcement section had an administrative checkpoint, primarily checking waterfowl hunters coming out of Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge a week ago, and they made about 49 contacts and discovered one untagged swan. We do have a new officer in our Colville district. His name is Dominic Barrett. And at that point, we actually have all our officers filled. We don't have any officer vacancies, but we do still have one sergeant vacancy. And then over the course of the winter and this spring, our officers will be doing saturation patrols on deer winter range to look for possible poaching events. If any of the RAC members have an interest in attending or joining one of the officers, please let me know and I'll get you linked up to that. In our outreach section, we have a new wildlife recreation technician. His name's James Abbott. And the opening day for the Hardware Ranch Elk Festival is December 3rd, which is a Saturday. And then we'll also be having several ice fishing clinics throughout the months of December, January, and February. So we'll be posting when those clinics will occur, but there'll be numerous ice fishing clinics throughout the northern region this winter. In our habitat section, they've completed the tunnel hollow fire reseeding and also our cold water wildlife management area reseeding project. In our wildlife section, our biologists are still busy classifying deer, looking at bucks, number of does, number of fawns. And so, again, if the RAC members have an interest in joining one of the biologists, please let me know and we'll get you linked up for that as well. And then this winter, the wildlife section will be focusing in on trapping and moving deer out of the city of Bountiful. And those deer will be going, about half of them will be going out to the Raft River Mountains, and the other half will be going to the northeastern region. In our aquatic section, we had a very successful Weber River Symposium in the middle of November. It was the first annual effort to try to bring all the different water users, those that had any interest in water in the Weber River watershed, together and talk about developing a collaborative effort to move forward, realizing that water is a very precious resource here in our state, and there's a lot of different interests in the use of that water. And I think it was a great, great success, a great start, and hopefully it'll lead to great partnerships further down the road when it comes to the Weber River watershed. The fisheries biologists are also busy building small, deployable habitat structures that we're putting into our community fisheries ponds. Some are very, very creative. One looks like Medusa's head. The other are bent and weaved wooden slats that provide structure for fish and hopefully exclude cormorant predation, because when we release the primarily rainbow trout into these community fisheries, once the cormorants pick up on that, they come in and of course they're a little more effective at fishing than some of our fishermen are. For the RAC members, there'll be a informational meeting, aquatic informational meeting, Thursday, March 19th, in the Central Region Conference Room. All RAC members are encouraged to attend. It'll be looking at some of the things that are going on in our aquatic section, including some biology, fish biology, and also an inner look at some of our hatchery management programs. So there'll be more information coming out on that, but please note that on your calendar. That's March 19th. There'll be that informational meeting in Springville. And then the division is planning to trap and move pronghorn from the Parker Mountain unit on December 16th. If there are any RAC members that have an interest in joining that activity, please let me know and we'll get you on a list. So if you have an interest, let me know tonight, because we need to develop that list by Friday. And the last thing I have is the division recently launched a new mobile application where you can get information about upcoming events. You can look at different illustrations for waterfowl, upland game, and fish. And you can also download your hunting and fishing licenses onto your smartphone. And that mobile app has been extremely popular. We've had about 10,000 downloads since it went live. And just as a reminder, if you have an iPhone and you want to download that free app, go to iTunes. And for Android users, you want to go to Google Play. But I personally find the app very, very helpful and user-friendly. So I would encourage you to do that. And also, your license, once it's downloaded, is a valid license. But remember, you still need your duck stamp if you're out hunting waterfowl. So either stick your duck stamp to the back of your smartphone and have it in your pocket. And that's all I have, unless there's any questions.
Did I mishear the date for the opening of Hardware Ranch? I think you said, at least I heard you say December 3rd, and that's today.
December 13th.
13th, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I got it.
Jeffrey.
It's not a comment. It's not a question for Justin, but a comment. You know how you keep us up to date on all these things each time? Well, I just wanted to say, and I hope you can pass this on to the powers that be, that these email updates we get from Mark Hadley are the most awesome things ever. I've never been more informed about all things natural resources in this state since he has been sending out those things to us. So that is, I wish everybody in the state could get that every time.
Yeah, thank you, and I'll pass along your comment to Mark.
So, Justin, on your license download, if you have to detach your permit, you're still going to have your paper license with you, though.
Correct? Yeah, you can download big game permits, but you still need to have that paper license or that paper permit with you. So the only thing that's valid would be a fishing, a combination license, or a small game hunting license.
I think you also can put your HIP number and your walk-in access authorization. So it's a really good app. I really like it.
Thank you, Justin. With that, we'll go to number 5, R657-59, Private Fish Ponds Rule Amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to fill in for Drew Cushing tonight. My name is Paul Thompson. I'm the Aquatics Manager for our Northern Region Office. Oh, that's not a good place to set that, is it? So I'd like to talk to you tonight about a small amendment we're proposing to the Private Fish Pond Rule. And the rule is R657-59. And hopefully this will come up so everybody can see here. So this rule the Private Fish Pond Rule provides private fish growers and private pond owners some instructions. And some of the basic instructions it provides are what species of privately grown fish may be stocked, whether fish stocked in private ponds need to be sterile or if they can be fertile, and what the responsibilities of the private pond owners and the private fish growers are.
Paul, could you get a little closer to the microphone, please?
So the purpose of this rule change, currently the pond owners may not pick up and transport their own fish without paying for and receiving a certificate of registration in advance. And for the private pond owners, this can be difficult, can be time-consuming, and it can be fairly expensive. So the change we're proposing is to allow private pond owners to transport their privately grown fish to their ponds without a certificate of registration if they are transporting small amounts of fish, and this would be less than 50 pounds. They are transporting sterile rainbow trout only. Doesn't apply for other species. There are other special restrictions and even outright prohibitions on some the management of other sterile fish in the state. So this is only for rainbow trout. And then they'll need to sign a formal affidavit or contract that assigns the responsibility and penalties for not living up to those responsibilities. And what this is still being developed, but what that'll basically be is they'll have to sign something where they testify that they are going to take the fish to where they say they're going to, and they can't just take them and release them somewhere else. So like I said, this is a very small amendment, but it should make it easier for the private pond growers that have smaller ponds and are purchasing smaller amounts of fish, especially the sterile rainbow trout, should save them money and allow them to transport the fish themselves. Thank you, and here for questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council on the presentation? Paul?
So, Paul, I'm wondering, is the division concerned with a number of additional vehicles and having the capacity to transport live fish being in the state with this?
Because that's what this proposal would do. Are you talking about division hatchery trucks, or are you talking about just
No, for people? Private, for private individuals to set up vehicles and transport capabilities within the state.
So for the numbers of fish that are being proposed, the less than 50 pounds, a lot of landowners, they have a small pond and they'll even want to purchase 10 trout. So you can put those in an aerated, in a cooler and probably drive them 15 minutes depending on the time of year and not have any issues. So they'll have to work with the private growers to make sure what they have will haul the fish for the distance needed. But what this really does, Paul, is the division about 5 years ago went through and we looked where we had native species concerns.
Correct.
And there's a good part of the state that there aren't concerns, and sterile rainbow trout can be stocked without even a certificate of registration. But if they're going to purchase the fish and try to transport them themselves, then they'll need to obtain a COR to do that. So they have growers transport the fish for them.
Correct.
Then they pay that fee as well.
Okay.
John Wall.
Yeah, I just had one question. How old are fish and how are they sterilized?
They're sterilized at the egg stage, and the private growers do it by pressure shocking the eggs, which makes them to where they can't be reproductively viable. There's another way to sterilize eggs too. It's heat shock at the egg stage, but the private growers are doing the pressure shock.
Then can the private pond owner have delivered from the hatcheries sterile ones that are not been sterilized?
Absolutely. So we have the growers have a whole host of different species that can be purchased, and then they will have to obtain a certificate of registration. And then we look at their ponds to make sure those fish can escape and they aren't being stocked in areas that we have concerns with other species. But we do those sort of certificates of registration. I do well over 100 to 200 a year.
Joel.
Why does this only apply to the rainbow trout and not other species?
Well, if you aren't going to be stocking a sterile fish, you need to have a certificate of registration anyway.
But can they sterilize other fish as well, not just rainbow
trout?
They can. So I'm thinking...
Okay. Like tiger trout?
Well, I'm thinking fish. Like down here in the valley, we have warmer waters, they're dirtier waters, and rainbow trout aren't going to survive.
Correct.
So I'm thinking bass and, you know, catfish, whatever.
So I do a lot of certificates of registration for bass and catfish down here
right,
in the valley.
Right,
but since they're fertile, we have that much more concern that they could go and put them into a water.
Can you not buy sterilized bass?
I don't know that they're available just
yet. I don't know.
Trout are definitely, in the last 5 years,
available.
We have a lot of trout available.
Okay.
I'm not sure they've come up with sterilizing. I know you can. I know some states do sterilize warm water fish, but I don't know that our growers are quite there yet.
Okay.
Jim.
So are there enough provisions in this that we could trace
If, for example, we get an outbreak of some new and unknown, a.k.a. whirling disease or something like that, that we could trace back origins without having the paperwork that we now have?
So the private growers have to have the paperwork on where they sell fish to and where they take fish and stock them. So they'll have the paperwork that they've sold them to these individuals and that they're going to this pond.
So you would track them from the seller rather than the buyer, but you're still comfortable with that?
Well, if they have fertile fish, we have the certificate of registration process, which we can track those fish. But where we don't have much concern with sterile rainbow trout, we just wanted to make it easier on those people that are just trying to get those fish. The private growers have to do like this, the division hatcheries, and they have to several times a year have all of their fish tested to make sure that they're pathogen free and they're not selling fish that have whirling disease. So I think there's enough things in place that it'll be caught as they're doing their certifications on their hatcheries. It's just like what we do. You got to certify them several times a year.
So what I'm suggesting is a disease shows up in a pond, and you know, some ponds are completely isolated, but some obviously that fish could escape and get into streams. Can we track that back to where they came from, knowing where they are now? So what are you going to go? You're going to go look at all the sellers and say, he bought some fish from this guy. Seems like a much more difficult thing than if he's got a CUR, you know who got them and where he got them from.
That's true. But I still think if that circumstance arose, we could find out eventually where those fish came from. And like I said, the private growers have to be disease certified. They can't be selling fish that have diseases. So that's why they're tested periodically through a year to make sure that they're giving clean fish out to the public, just like we do with our hatcheries when we stock public waters.
Sure, assuming that they're buying them from a reputable source. That would be my concern.
There's only certified growers that you can purchase fish from.
Is this going to have any interstate ramifications? Can they go to Colorado and bring 50 pounds? Is not very many pounds, but right. It could be a lot of fish if they're 4 inches long.
That's true. And that's a great question, because we do have private growers that provide fish within the state, and I'm not sure about transport across state borders with those fish.
Okay.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we'll go to public comment. We have one blue card, Neil Barker. Right up here at the microphone in the middle there.
I haven't done this, so appreciate. My name's Neil Barker. I'm the owner of Cold Springs Trout Farm in North Ogden. I was asked to come here by Rob Judd, Utah Aquaculture Association. I just want to thank the division for listening to some of our concerns in the industry. It is a concern where we go out and stock ponds, and then we have somebody that calls up that wants 10 fish for an aquaponics system. And there's not much profit in 10 fish. Last year I drove to Provo to drop off 3 fish for a Boy Scout activity. Didn't make a thing. So there is a need, and I think if we make it easier, like it's suggested here, then people will purchase from reputable sources. If not, they're going to go out and find fish somewhere else that's not reputable. We do go through all the disease testing. Let's see, a couple other things that I would like to mention. I think this is a step in the right direction. I would like to see it open up to more than just rainbow trout. We do, like your comment, we raise sterile brook, brown, tiger trout, rainbow trout. We do have bass, a hybrid striped bass. They're sterile. And it would be, I'd like to see this come up in the future where we could allow those to be stocked, because a lot of the systems, especially a backyard system, is going to have some warm water issues. And rainbow trout usually will die at 70 degree water. Tiger trout can handle up to about 75. So there are some real advantages to allowing tiger trout or brown, sterile brown trout or a hybrid bass to be taken as well. And we're going to see the same situation where they're just going to want a few of them for their aquaponic system. So that's pretty much all the comments that I have. But I do want to thank the division for listening to us.
Thank you very much, Neil. And I'm sure Paul will forward your additional comments to Drew. So that's all the blue cards we have on this agenda item. Anyone else from the public care to comment on this topic? Okay, seeing none, we'll go back to the council. Comments from the council? And or motions?
Yeah, I make a motion that we accept the amended R657-59 as presented.
So we have a motion from John Wall and a second from Joel Ferry to recommend the Wildlife Board approve R657-59 private fish ponds rule amendments as presented. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand, say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
We'll go on to item number 6, 2015 Black Bear Recommendations and Rule Amendments. While Leslie's getting set up, I will. Justin corrected me. On the preference point rule, the Wildlife Board tabled that because as part of the mule deer management plan, there is a recommendation in there to study possibly unifying the drawings, the point systems. So the Wildlife Board tabled that. The preference point system for mule deer will stay the same for the next year. And then we'll probably be seeing some recommendations come through the division to possibly change how we do the drawings. Go ahead, Leslie.
Okay. So I'm going to apologize up front. I'm fighting a scratchy throat, so I'll try not to make weird noises. But so I just want to go into a little bit of background first on our bear recommendations that we're going to make. Utah does have a 12-year management plan that went through the public process and was approved by the RAC and the Wildlife Board in 2011. The plan was assembled and recommended by the Utah Black Bear Advisory Committee, which consisted of the following members, which are listed up here. Members and groups. The plan requires that the DWR recommend permits on a 3-year basis. The plan is effective for 12 years, so during the 12-year period, we will have 4 recommendations that will last for a period of 3 years. All of the permit numbers that we are recommending tonight fall within the recommended guidelines from this Black Bear Management Plan. Some of the directives and objectives in the plan direct us to evaluate some of the seasons that we have and possibly manipulate those to help control some of the problems that we're seeing relative to livestock loss and human conflict. So our plan goal is to maintain a healthy bear population in existing occupied habitat and expand distribution while considering human safety, nuisance problems, livestock, and depredation concerns, habitat limitations, and possible impacts on other wildlife species. According to the plan, a healthy bear population is defined as one that has a proportion of breeding age animals that will maintain population levels consistent with habitat and will also allow for genetic variability. So one of our objectives in this plan is to maintain a stable bear population while considering other wildlife populations, the level of human-bear conflict that we see across the state, and general population dynamics. The Black Bear Plan establishes three strategies that we can manage our bear populations under. A light strategy is one where there's little to no human-bear conflict occurring in an area, and one where we manage for older age males to occur in the population. But in order to select a light strategy, you have to have little to no human conflict and no livestock conflict. About less than 25% of our units fall under that strategy. A moderate harvest strategy is where most of our bear management units fall under. And in order to be selected for this, you have to have moderate to low human conflict or livestock conflict with bears. We like to see adult males greater than 5 years old, and we like to maintain a low level of those in the harvest. And we do like to see some female harvest in these areas to help control populations. A liberal harvest strategy is used on less than 25% of our units, and I can say that only 5 of them this year qualify. This one, we want younger males to make up the harvest in these populations. We want the female harvest to be about 40 to 45% because we are trying to affect these populations because we're having a lot of conflict in these areas. And again, these are outlined in the plan that was approved in 2011. So our current status of bear population in our state, we are fortunate in that bears are very long-lived species. And we do have a pretty strict reporting requirement for all of our hunters. All bears are required to be brought in and checked in, and then we take a tooth from each one of these animals. We turn those teeth in, and so with our bear populations, we know the age and the sex of the bears that are harvested. This is a long-term data set that we've been collecting for a long time. And so to kind of estimate our population, this is not a model, and I want to make that really clear. It is not a model. What it is a population reconstruction. So you can take the ages of your bears and you can kind of build your population back. And the age of bears in your harvest, when you build that back up, tell you how many bears you should have in your population at a given time point. And so then you can kind of build back your population and tell you at a minimum what you would have for male bears in your population. Doing this, we estimate that we have about 1,500 male bears. Using that, we can extrapolate if you had equal numbers of adult females that you have for adult males, that would equal about 3,000 bears. But we know that we have more females in the population than males. So we can kind of estimate that we probably have about 4,100 bears in our state. The population density estimates that were done in 2009 estimated about 3,500. Based on these growth rates, we believe that we're seeing about a 5 to 6% increase in our bears per year. One other metric that we use to evaluate our bear populations, we have female bears that are collared around the state, and we do go into those dens every year. We take and we look at the number of young in the dens, and we average all of that over a 5-year period. We look at that, and if out of 2 of the 5 years we do see yearling cubs in the den with females, then we call that a population recruitment. We know that bears are doing well and that we're adding to the population. And the plan does state that if we do detect that recruitment, we are to increase permits by 20%. So looking at the permits and things that we've been issuing, here's kind of a historical representation. The line with the triangles are the number of permits that we've been offering. You can see that when this plan was implemented in 2010, and for some reason the years aren't showing up on this, but 2011 is the first of the three triangles, so those were the last 3 year cycle that we just went through. We did increase permits quite significantly, but as you can see, the harvest on the bears didn't increase quite dramatic. It didn't really increase dramatically. The light gray colored bar is sport harvest. The dark colored gray part of the bar is depredation, human and nuisance take by Wildlife Services and our agency. You can see that this past year, we did have an inordinate number of bears that were taken because they were aggressive with people. They got into trouble with livestock. On an average, we see about 50 bears that we have to be removed. This past year, it went up to 81. So one of the main objectives that is written into the bear management plan is that the agency is to work to shift mortality and take out of the depredation and nuisance category and try and shift that over to sport take and try and use hunters to remove that instead of the agency. And so some of our recommendations tonight are meant or trying to do this so that the agency is not having to remove so many bears. And I think it's important to note at this time that if bears are getting into trouble, they will be removed. And so if we can use sportsmen and the public to help us do that, the plan does dictate that that's where we're to go. Okay, so we have had a spring season for the past 3 years. The plan does direct us to evaluate that and make adjustments where we can to try and reduce depredation and nuisance problems. And so after this first 3 years of doing this season, we are recommending some changes. We have had some conflicts between different hunt types, both hounds and bait, and so we're trying to eliminate some of those issues. So we're recommending a spring limited entry season. No bait would be allowed during this time, and the primary method would be hounds or spot and stalk. We'd be adding 1 week to the end of the season to help deal with access issues in areas of high elevation where you can't get in because of snow. The new recommendation is to add a summer limited entry. This time period would go from June 6th to July 2nd. This is to try and change the timing of harvest to help eliminate and control some of the problems that we have with bears getting into campgrounds. Most of our campground stuff starts occurring around the 4th of July, and it gets really heavy towards the end of July. So this is a way to try and help eliminate some of those problems. We'd allow harvest with any legal weapon, and we would not allow hounds during this time period because it is a fawning and calving season. We would allow bait hunters to begin baiting 1 week prior to the opening of the season, but they could not begin hunting until June 6th. Okay, so harvest objective is one of our strategies that we use in areas where we're having a lot of conflict. Like I said, this is only 5 units in the entire state. We do have some recommendations for spring and fall season dates. We're not recommending any changes to this strategy. Unlimited permits are sold during the season, but it closes when a quota is met or the season ends. We are recommending a fall limited entry archery only bait only hunt on the Book Cliffs unit. This is the entire Book Cliffs. Weapon type would be limited to archery tackle only. And a lot of this is treated as conflict between other hunters that are out in the field at this time, primarily limited entry archery elk hunters. You could have a bait station or you could do spot and stalk during this hunt. And again, this is only on the Book Cliffs. Fall limited entry, there are no changes to this strategy. Right now we're recommending the LaSalle and San Juan units for a different season date. And this is primarily to deal with issues and conflicts between limited entry elk hunters on the LaSalle and San Juan units and bear hunters. And then the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek would have a fall hunt October 6th through November 19th. It wouldn't have the whole season. We are recommending some limited entry spot and stalk hunts, primarily in the Book Cliffs Little Creek Roadless area. We have a spring and a fall season, and then a LaSalle and a San Juan spot and stalk hunt. These are really low success hunt because basically, you have to walk around and try and find a bear. We have the multi-season hunt. You can hunt any of the seasons for the approved unit that your permit is authorized for. Previously, this was known as a premium hunt. We're changing the name to be consistent with big game, which just changed it to multi-season. This hunt type or this permit cannot be used during harvest objective units or on pursuit seasons. Randy?
Mr. Chairman, Leslie asked me to briefly talk about the Northern Region recommendations, if that's okay. As you can see up there on the board, those are our recommendations. The first unit is the Cache, East Canyon, Morgan, South Ridge, and Ogden units. As you can see in both of them, we're looking or recommending an increase in permits. And the reason we want to increase is to increase harvest. We want to increase harvest in both of them. Looking at the first unit, the Cache, the units 2, 3, 4, and 5, in the last 3 years, and this is stuff that the data I'm going to give you is 3 years. So in the last 3 years, we've had 12 permits, and out of those 12 permits, we've harvested 3 bears. In that same time frame, depredation, nuisance, and wildlife services have taken 4 bears out of there. So we do want to increase harvest in this area to cut back on nuisance problems and that, and try to shift some of the take over to sportsmen. In that 3 years, all the 7 animals, there were 0 females taken in that area. Looking on to Chalk Creek, Camas, North Slope, Summit area, again, you can see we're increasing by 4 permits. And that's the same reason we want to shift harvest over. And in the last 3 years, in this unit, we've had 39 permits. And of those 39 permits, we had 10 bears harvested. In the Nuisance Depredation Wildlife Services, we had 12 bears harvested. So again, what we're trying to do is shift some of that take over to the sportsmen. In the hunter harvest, we are right at about 40% females in the take in this unit. It is in a liberal harvest, so that puts us kind of, if you look back at that slide, down right in where we want to be on the harvest. And that's just briefly what we're doing in the northern region.
Thanks, Randy. So the other regions... as you look at this, the first column is spring limited entry where it says quota. Those are the units with harvest objective. if it says spot and stock, they're limited entry and they're spot and stock hunting only. Then the second column over is summer limited entry. There's a fall limited entry, and then the fall archery baits only, and that's only on the book cliffs. And then the multi-season, as you can see as you go over, you can see the adjustment from the past 3 years, the number of permits that we're increasing. Some of these say same because we aren't having issues on those units, and so we did not increase permits, harvest, or, and we don't want to mess with what we're doing on those units because those bear populations are doing all right. Central region, they just have a couple of units. The Wasatch Mountains West unit, they've had an inordinate amount of livestock depredation in that unit, and so we are trying to increase bear harvest there because of the conflicts that they've had with cabin owners and the conflicts that they've had with livestock. Southeastern region, the La Salle and San Juan are some of our biggest bear units, but it's also where we've had a lot of problems with bear conflicts. The bear populations are doing really well there, but we're having a lot of conflict, and so we're trying to help decrease some of that conflict by increasing some of the permit opportunities there. Southern region, there are not a whole lot of changes there. That region has not had horrible issues or anything with human conflict with bears, except for on the beaver unit, and that one did increase by 5, but the other units, it's relatively small changes. So our average statewide success rate, and it averages about 42% to 45% across the state. The success rate also varies, though, by the hunt type that it is. Bait hunters are about 47% successful. Hound hunters are about 45% successful. And like I said, spot and stock is a really hard hunt to do because you basically have to wander around and hope you find a bear if you're one of those hunters. This past year, sport hunters harvested 270 bears. Overall take, including all of the depredation and nuisance, was 330. What we would like to do is increase the sport harvest to 320 because we have to remove these bears anyway when they get into trouble. And so what we're trying to do is shift that so that it's more sport take and reduce the government take of animals. If the harvest is below 270, so it's 20% lower, we would like to come in next year and reevaluate what we've offered or what we've recommended. And if it's greater than 320, we also want to evaluate it and maybe come in and adjust things. Typically, with the plan that we have, we're only supposed to look at it every 3 years. But because we are recommending some changes, we want to be conservative with what we do and really evaluate what we've recommended. There is one boundary change request out of the southeastern region. This is the Central Mountains Manti South. They're adding a portion of the San Rafael North. The San Rafael North is not a bear management unit, but they do have bears that come off of the Manti, and they have been getting into trouble into some livestock and things. So we're adding that part of the unit to the Central Mountains to try and help address some of those issues. General pursuit season, there are no recommended changes from those season dates. They're recommended to continue as they have in the past. Restricted pursuits, we are recommending both on the La Salle and the San Juan and the Book Cliffs areas both fall or both summer seasons. There has been an issue with bears getting into melon crops in southeastern Utah. One bear can get into these melon crops and in one night can destroy an entire crop of watermelons. And this past year, our agency had to remove 13 bears that got into a commercial melon crop that caused extensive damage. And so we're trying to look at a way to have the landowner help control the problem so that we get it before they actually destroy the entire crop. So the recommendation is that we be allowed to issue a bear control permit to a landowner, immediate family member, or employees that work for that landowner to remove problem bears. This would be only on commercial cultivated crops, and so they have to demonstrate that they are doing it for a profit. It has to be a minimum of 5 acres of privately owned land, and it has to be enrolled in Greenbelt. They have to be able to show that they've either had chronic bear damage, a history of it, or they currently have to have chronic bear damage occurring. And the crop owner must notify us immediately after they take the bear. We are requesting a change. We do have a bear orientation course that's mandatory for all bear permit holders. We are requesting to change this orientation course to make it mandatory before they can apply for a permit, and this would be on an annual basis. Currently, only those that draw the permit are required to take the course. We've had a lot of problems trying to get hunters to take the course after they get the permit, and then they don't end up getting their permit. We feel that this will be a really effective tool to help educate our bear hunters on hunting methods, ethics, and bear identification and population management tools and that type of thing. And so we want to use this as an education tool. There are some housekeeping rule modifications. Mostly it was to put in the wording for crossbows that have been previously approved, change the name from premium permit to multi-season, changes to allow for the crop depredation, shorten the waiting period from 7 days to 3 days on harvest objective permit purchases, and again, allow any weapon to be used over bait. And that's what I have for you.
Thank you, Leslie. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? If so, please come up to the microphone, state your name, and ask your question.
I'm Buzz Marthaler. I'm with the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. I've got a lot of questions, so maybe you can educate me here. First, I'd like to say the mandatory education I really like. I think more things should be mandatory in that sense, and so I applaud that. Is it true that it's illegal to shoot a sow with cubs?
Yes.
Okay, so one of my questions is a bait station set up to attract bears. Sows will often put their cubs down and come in by themselves. How do we educate, and how do you tell that she's a sow with cubs?
So there are ways that you can tell, and it does require sitting and watching the bear to see if she is lactating and those types of things. But if a person spends the time, they can tell if a female is lactating, and that would be part of our orientation course, is ways to differentiate those things so that they don't accidentally take a sow with cubs.
Okay. Because I would be concerned about those cubs becoming depredation.
Absolutely.
Issues, as well as starving to death.
We do, so, too.
All right, good. Livestock losses, did you have some data on livestock issues?
Yeah, so there were 44 bears that were taken this year by Wildlife Services. There were 33 that were taken by our agency, and then another 5 or 6 that were taken because of humans felt threatened.
So we've actually lost livestock. I'm not talking about crops and things like that.
Yeah, so there were 44 bears that were taken for livestock losses.
Right. And then
we average, and to go back on that, we average about 50 bears a year, every year, that are taken for livestock loss.
Okay. And I am actually an advocate for letting Wildlife Services, I don't care for their job, but
Buzz,
I think...
Focus on your questions, and then we'll have the comment period.
Got it. I'm sorry. Yeah. And then I have another question. Did I get it right? One of the harvest seasons ended on June 5th?
Yes.
And then the bait season started on June 6th?
Yes.
And you could bait 1 week prior to that June 6th?
Yes.
Which would mean we would possibly be drawing bears to a bait station for hunters that are not baiting. Is there an issue or a problem?
Yeah, it is in our law that you cannot run dogs off of bait. And so that is already prohibited.
Okay. All right. So that was a pursuit and harvest?
Pursuit and spot and stock season is the spring season.
Got it. All right. I think that's good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Additional questions from the public?
Yes. Kirk Robinson, Western Wildlife Conservancy. I have a couple of questions, Leslie. One has to do with, they both have to do with science and what studies might have been done with respect to how baiting affects population trends, and another one, how baiting affects the behavior of bears with respect to habituation to people and or human foods at campgrounds. I'm not here to comment on that right now. I'll do that later. But I've done some research of my own, and I have not come up with studies that address either of those questions. And I'm just wondering if you're aware of it.
So the last one was in the 10th annual Bear Proceedings, the Bear Workshop. There was a paper that was put out. And I've got it right here. Let me find it. Sorry. It looked at baiting. They were using baiting as an alternate method to pull bears away, and it was within a park where they had a lot of nuisance problems. And so what they were doing was using baiting to draw the bears away from the park. And the conclusions from the paper were that they did not see issues. The bear that they ended up having to euthanize was one that never found the baiting stations and went directly into the park. They found that they didn't become habituated to people. They became habituated to the locations where the baiting stations were located. And I'm trying to find that. It was the wildlife.
Well, maybe you can give me a reference later.
I can. I'll get you that paper. Right. I'll email it to you, actually.
Okay. Maybe one other question, if I may, having to do with baiting and the probability of orphaning cubs. I understand what you do to try to minimize that. Do you have any way of trying to assess how often lactating females are killed? How often baby bears are orphaned? Is there any information on that?
So we do require that all bears have to be checked in by us, and we do evaluate those bears when they come in. Most of the bear take that we see are males, and we do require our people to check to see if the female is lactating at the time that she's checked in. To my knowledge, it doesn't occur very often because it is illegal to do.
I can't go back and say, but
they are required to check for that when they check those bears in, and every bear has to be checked in.
I understand that, but I mean, if a person kills a lactating female, they're not automatically penalized in any way, are they?
Law enforcement help.
Well, my original question was just that. Do you have some way of trying to get data on how frequently that happens?
Yes, we try and evaluate that. But it does, you know,
The legal issue is another one. Yeah. All right. That's all I want to know. Thank you.
Do we have any additional questions from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Questions from the council. John Wall.
Out of the bears that were taken by the services, what percent were males compared to females, especially on the livestock?
Easier to do at this. Sorry, it'll take me a second to just find it. a sec. We've got too many files. Do you have the harvest one out? Okay, so depredation by Wildlife Service, it's not broken out by which agency did it, but we took 42 males and 24 females, and two that were unknown.
Leslie, I know in the past we had I think if you had a baiting station, you had to register that with the land management agency. Is that still in effect?
Yes.
Okay, so that will apply to all our new hunts where baiting could be possible.
Yes.
Okay.
And just one real quick that was just a concern that was brought up. On those bait stations, when we assessed the permits that we would put out for that spring bait, we went back and looked at the historical CORs for each of those areas and tried to set it within that frame so that we wouldn't be impacting those land management agencies further than what they had been in the past.
Okay. And then could you go to the slide that showed the permits and the number of bears taken? So the last three, the highest three triangles are the years in our current management plan.
They are in our current management plan, and I want to stress here that that huge jump in permits were 95 spot and stop permits that were put out there. So even though we increased the permits quite dramatically, they were a very low success type permit. So that's why you don't see the huge
increase
jump
in harvest. Okay. Additional questions, Jim?
So why do you think that our bear population is increasing? What factors are involved, or do you know?
So what we're seeing through our bear denning data, we're seeing recruitment into the population because we're seeing yearlings that are, we're seeing females that are successful raising cubs.
Yeah, the question is why?
Because conditions are right. They have, I mean, I don't know how else to say it other than that. I mean, we're not having really horrible winters. The summers, the fall season have been filled with lots of rain and things, and so there's been enough mast and things for them to put on a lot of fat. And so they're doing really well. And then you have seasons like this that you've got not a whole lot of snow, and it's still relatively warm, and so they do really well in these types of conditions.
Okay. Is it pretty much a general statewide increase, or is it some areas are greater increase than others? Do you have any idea?
Some areas have seen, and so I want to stress that we're trying to be responsive to the areas that we're having problems. And so we are seeing an increase overall, but we're trying to target the areas where we're having problems with bears mostly.
Okay. John Cabot.
Thank you, Leslie. How many collared females are you monitoring for the productivity information?
Each region was asked to do a minimum of 5, and some have much more than that.
And then, why is the bear orientation course annual? Stuff is changing that you need to keep?
Well, I think it's an important reminder. I went to Montana, and they require that of the hunters in Montana, mostly because they're trying to educate people the differences between black bears and grizzlies. But honestly, I think as hunters, we can forget things, and I think it's a really important way for us to get out the message to be careful about sows with females, to be careful about this, and it's a good way to reinforce that with our hunters.
And then finally, do you think that increasing the sportsman permits are going to get at the problem bear issues? It seems like it would be a more effective strategy to target those with depredation permits.
So that's what we're trying to do, though, is increase in the areas where we're having the problems, and we're trying to target the seasons where we're having the problems. And we're hoping to reverse that trend so that we're not having to be the ones that are always doing that. And so we're hoping by targeting those areas, and that's why it's not an across-the-board increase everywhere. It's in those targeted areas.
Chris?
Leslie, could you please describe the type of conflicts that have occurred between hound and bait hunters that have driven some of the changes that you're recommending?
So the majority of what we have had problems with, so bait hunters, it takes some time to get bears accustomed to get bears to find your bait station. And so a bait hunter will take a couple weeks trying to get a bear to find it, and then when they do get a bear to find it and they go in, here comes a houndsman running through. And it's not always, you know, it's accidental, because if you're a houndsman and you go out and there's a bait in the area, you're probably going to run across that bait. And so we're trying to, and then there have been reports that houndsmen purposefully set off a bait, and so we're just trying to eliminate, one, the perception that that's occurring, and two, we're trying to eliminate the conflict and separate that.
Another question. Just as the waiting period, we're trying to realign the waiting periods on the harvest objective permits from 7 to 3 days, just to be consistent. Why is the waiting period necessary to be 3 days? If it's a problem bear?
The reason that it was set at 3 days was so that somebody couldn't go kill an animal first and then go purchase a permit and put it on the animal. So we wanted a waiting period in there so that things like canned hunts couldn't possibly occur and that type of thing.
What is greenbelt status and what qualifies as a history of chronic depredation?
So pretty much this implementation, we're writing it as a statewide rule, but really it was putting it in place to help address specific problems in Green River, Utah. Green River, they grow a lot of watermelons, and then they're on the south end of the Book Cliffs where we have a lot of bears. So greenbelt status is your agricultural tax status, and so it means that you... And I can't remember the greenbelt. It has to be a minimum of 5 acres, but you're doing it for agricultural tax deductions and things. And I can't remember. Do you remember the greenbelt law, Randy? No. I don't have it off the top of my head, but that's the reason why, is we want to make sure that they're participating in the agricultural and that it's not a hobby-type farm.
Okay, and a history of chronic depredation, what qualifies?
It's going to probably be those same melon farmers that we know have a history of doing that. So one person in 1 year would not be a history, but we know these same people every year have the same problems with the same bears in the same area, and we know it's going to occur.
Any particular number or level of data that, you know, must be sustained before we say, okay, that qualifies as a history?
There's very few there's nothing in the state besides the area in Green River that would have a history of chronic depredation. There's nothing.
Okay, and one last question. If the division determines that a hunter has taken a lactating female, is there any follow-up that occurs to the site of the kill to look for cubs that may not, you know, be mature enough to be out on their own?
It would depend on each region. It would depend on the law enforcement personnel and the biologists that were involved in that. I can't speak on each location, but, yeah, they would make an effort to follow that out.
But there's no particular policy, but it's the right thing to do, and so
right.
We hope that follow-up happens.
Right, and it is against the law to take a lactating female. If we could prove that, then it would be followed through with. Correct, guys?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Leslie, do you have a value for how much depredation payments we make in the Green River area? Do you have an idea?
We do not pay depredation, crop depredation on bears.
Okay.
At all. It's not approved through the legislature. So that's part of this, to prevent having to go there.
All right. Bruce?
Is there a correlation between habitat quality and the bears going into the agriculture? That's the first question. And the second is, has agriculture used hazing?
Yes, we use hazing there quite frequently, and this past summer our employees were there constantly. There is an employee that lives just in Green River that specifically spent the summer hazing bears out of that field. What was the first part, though?
The first part is, are the bears moving out of their natural habitat because of habitat quality, or is it simply path of least resistance? They like
melons. It really has nothing to do with the habitat. They're attracted to the melons.
Do we have any additional questions from Kemp Paul?
Leslie, I have a couple of questions. First one, so based on your presentation here, we're actually increasing the length of the hunt during June and into July that wasn't there before. Is that correct?
Yes.
And is there any concern over our recreating public who is out there and the chance of coming upon a bait station? Because we're switching also from a archery hunt system to an any legal weapon system, right?
Yeah. So as far as going from archery to any weapon, it wouldn't be different than going rifle deer hunting. So, I mean, it's the same concept. As far as trying to, we were very conscious in trying to end that baiting season before July, so we end it July 2nd, so that we try and end it before the 4th of July weekend, which we know is a big camping holiday weekend.
And I guess what I look at is it's more of a comment, but I find myself concerned in that people are used to seeing people out hunting with rifles in the fall, not necessarily in June.
So with a bait station, you're fairly close to your bait station. It's not like deer hunting where you're shooting across canyons and rather long distance shots.
I understand that.
It's closer.
And so my other concern is all of a sudden we're putting, if I understand correctly, we're putting those bait stations out there and hunters out there when we also have livestock going out that previously weren't there.
So we've worked quite a bit with Wildlife Services, and we've discussed this quite a bit with them, and they feel that it will help in areas where they've got livestock problems because it will help take bears away from the livestock.
Thought process, though, was really more of a hunter mistaking a cow for a bear.
Well, hopefully with a bait station, you're much closer to it than, I mean, you're not shooting across a canyon. Yeah.
Here again,
a bait.
It's any weapon, though, so you've got a longer distance.
But you're not shooting across a canyon at your bait station. You're going to be close to your bait station.
Then my next question is, we also, this proposal adds fall bait stations, is that correct?
No, fall bait stations are already allowed.
Okay. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Craig.
Yeah, I have a question, Leslie. What kind of conflicts do you see between big game limited entry and once in a lifetime hunts happening when there are bear hound hunts?
We see a lot of conflict.
So, okay.
I don't know what to.
Jim?
But that isn't anything new. We've had that for a long time, right?
Yeah, and so the shortened season that you see on the La Salle and the San Juan is shortened that way to try and address that very issue. We had some incidents over the past couple years where we actually had some people threatened to shoot each other because a houndsman ran in through a guy that it took 20 years for him to draw his limited entry elk permit. So the shortened season in the La Salle and the San Juan were put there for that reason, to try and eliminate that conflict.
Bryce.
You got that problem, I mean, on every unit. Why just limit it on those two?
Because then we'd end up with no bear hunting in the fall anywhere.
No, I know. So why limit it on those two? Why just leave it the way it is on all of
them? The San Juan and the La Salle are treated the same as far as harvest, but the San Juan is one of the premier elk units in the state. As
premier
far as,
bear unit in the state, though, too, on the other hand, right?
I know, but...
I guess I'm just saying, why isn't it the same? Got one other question. So they have 2 months to... 2 months to chase with hounds, and then 1 month to chase, or I mean, to hunt with the bait. That month is typically when the bears have rubbed, you know, and they're not as trophy quality, I guess, for most people. Why not, I don't know, make it a little fair for those guys? More so in May.
What do you mean, put bait back in May?
Well, either or.
I mean, we can go back to what we had before, which was April to the end of May.
It just seems like it favors the houndsmen more so than the bait guys.
Not necessarily. We can go back to what we had before, which was a spring limited entry, and it goes April to May and ends there. I mean, the whole reason that we did that was to try and prevent the conflicts that we get complaints on with between the bait and the hounds. And the spring season is a very desired season. We tried to give them both the end of May, and then we gave the other one the first part of June.
But it seems like the houndsmen have the better, I guess, better time.
Well, because we can't put hounds out in June, because then they're running through fawning and calving areas, and it impacts our ungulates.
Yeah, so I guess...
I mean, we're just trying to mitigate where we can. We were trying to use that June season as a way to help eliminate conflicts and use bait hunters to do that. But if it's not going to work, we could go back to...
Well, I guess, and the reason why I say is because, I mean, I'm not a bear hunter, been one time. A lot of the guys I know go out of state, do it in the month of May, and hunt over baits. So it just seems like, you know, you push it to June... Guys, there's a lot of people that don't have dogs, and it costs money to hire somebody with dogs. Then now they're going to have kind of a, I don't know, not a very good season to do it.
Well, we could certainly move them back together and go back and end it the first part of June and not have any June hunt. That would be the way to make it fair and equal for both.
Leslie, historically we had a lot of conflict on the La Salle's and the San Juan, growing up down there. I know that, and that is your experience, correct?
Yes.
That was our earliest conflict area, I think, or the one that became a problem initially?
Yes.
Okay. Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we're going to go to blue cards from the public. Ben Louder. Now, if someone has presented your basic opinion and you'd like to support them, please feel free to go ahead and state that. And then if you don't have anything new, then we could definitely move through this a little bit faster. So go ahead, Ben.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ben Louder. I'm here representing the Utah Bowman's Association tonight. I handed out a copy of my proposal to all of you when I got here this evening, so you should all have a copy of it if you'd like to follow along and be able to read what I'm proposing here tonight. First of all, I'd like to thank Leslie for the effort and the work that she's put into this plan. We believe that she's done a pretty good job, we understand that there's a lot of changes that have been recommended, and we understand there's been a lot of work that goes into that. A couple days ago, I met with leaders from Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, the Utah Houndsmen Association, and the United Wildlife Cooperative, and we discussed these changes. We brought up each of our concerns with some of the changes as we had them and addressed them individually and came together on a recommendation that we feel addresses all of our concerns and we're able to do so as a joint proposal. So this is a joint proposal between the Utah Bowman's Association, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, the Utah Houndsmen Association, and the United Wildlife Cooperative. We support the division's proposals with four exceptions, and I'll outline those exceptions and explain them in detail. And I believe some of these exceptions addresses some of the questions that have been asked here already tonight. The first exception is concerning that summer season. As Bryce had asked about that shortened summer season, we have similar concerns with the rubbing of the bears, as well as that shortened time frame. Baiting is very time intensive. It takes a long time in order to do it effectively. And so we are asking for an additional 2 weeks of season on the front end of that summer season to overlap that spring season. As has been mentioned, for years we've been hunting together. That's April-May season, and I understand that there have been conflicts at times. I believe that the majority of those hound baiting conflicts are incidental, and we believe that that providing an additional 2 weeks on the front end of that summer season is the best compromise to maximize the time and field for all types of bear hunters. We believe that the conflicts will be minimal, and again, after that two-week overlapping season, the bait hunters will have approximately 27 days without hounds, and so we believe that that's a great compromise for both parties. The next exception is concerning the San Juan and LaSalle fall bear hunting dates. We disagree that those seasons should be shortened. We'd like to see them mirror the rest of the fall bear seasons throughout the state. The reason for that is those units are very large units, and as was mentioned, San Juan is a premier elk unit. It's also a premier bear unit. I have hunters in my membership that hunt both elk and that hunt bears. I cannot tell one of them that their season or choice of hunt is more important than the other. And in addition, each of those units only has 5 bear permits on the LaSalle and on the San Juan. It's a very minimal number of permits in the fall. I can speak to this personally. We currently are hunting limited entry elk on both of those units during that fall bear hunt. The seasons are almost an exact mirror of each other. And in the last 2 years, I've spent about 30 days on San Juan during that fall elk and bear hunt. I had the privilege of holding an elk permit last year and the privilege of helping a friend with a permit this year. We never saw or never had any issues with houndsmen during that season. And we also believe that by spreading out, by matching those seasons, making those seasons longer, that you will spread those bear hunters out across more time as well. In addition, we'd like to see the spring and summer tags drawn from the same pool to address future demand issues as these season structures and the changes to the baiting regulations we believe could change the demands of where people want to hunt bears or when they want to hunt bears. And then the last point is with the spring harvest objective seasons, we'd like to see those remain harvest objective for residents but go to a limited entry type system for non-residents. We believe that that there's been precedent set for doing so already. Idaho has a similar structure. If anybody's interested in seeing more details of that, I could address that. But essentially, they for running hounds in Idaho, hound permits in Idaho are unlimited for residents, and they are limited, and you have to apply for them for non-residents. And so we believe that that would work here as well. I'll wrap up real quick. Again, this is a joint proposal from Utah Bowman's Association, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, the Utah Houndsmen Association, and the United Wildlife Cooperative. If you have any questions concerning my proposal during your discussion, I'd be more than willing to address them. Thanks for your time.
Hang on a second, Ben. So does the council have any questions for Ben on the proposal he's presented that you have right now? Bruce.
I have a quick question. I don't understand what you mean by future demand of bear hunters. You know, I'm reading what you got here, but I don't really understand that.
Sure. So with the recommendations that are on the table, where the changes in the season dates are huge changes. That summer season is a brand new season. We've never had that before. Also, we're recommending, the division is recommended to allow any weapon hunting on bait. In the past, it's only been archery. And so I believe that those two changes could change the demands on the ways that people want to hunt.
I see. So future demand based on the proposed regulations.
Exactly.
Okay. I'm going to ask Leslie, you hang out.
Okay.
Let's have
sure.
Leslie comment on your proposal while it's still fresh in our minds. We have it.
Thank you.
Okay.
I would like to respond to this recommendation on behalf of the division. As far as the set summer season hunt dates to allow 2 weeks earlier, we would be opposed to that because our primary reason for splitting those out was to try and prevent conflict. So we do oppose that request. We did meet earlier and we did agree to allow them to pre-bait 1 week prior, but we did not want them to begin hunting until June 4th to try and prevent the conflicts. As far as the San Juan and La Salle fall dates, I did mention that earlier. We do have concerns over conflicts. It has gotten quite ugly for the region down there in the past with guns and threats to kill each other. And so we do have concerns over the impact that it has on that limited entry elk period. As far as drawing spring and summer season tags from the same tag pool, we do have concerns for that because when we went through and established the spring bait permit numbers, we tried to look at previous CORs that were applied for bait stations in the spring and keep it even with that because if we put them all in the same tag pool and there are 35 permits offered in the spring and all 35 people chose to go that summer bait season instead of the splitting somehow between both seasons, you could potentially end up with 70 people baiting in June. And, well, 70 bait stations, 30, because you can have two bait stations per person. And so we do have concerns that not setting that out front could impact land managing agencies. As far as the spring harvest objective seasons and limited entry opportunity for residents, I did, after I received this at last night's RAC, I did meet with our Attorney General this morning, and there is the possibility that we are creating an unequal opportunity there by discriminating against non-residents. And so if it were to go that way, we would prefer to drop the harvest objective recommendation, double the permits for that area, and then split it out 90-10 like we do for all the other hunts.
Do you have any comments?
Yeah, if I can.
Okay, let's just make it real quick.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Most of it I've already touched on.
Yeah.
But concerning the overlap of the spring and summer hunt, again, we feel that's the best compromise to maximize days and fields for all types of hunters, and
okay.
We believe conflicts will be minimal. The drawing the spring and summer tags out of the same pool, the concern that Leslie has about it's possible but unlikely that all permits would go to the summer season. And even if that did happen, we've never had a summer season before. The spring season that we've always had has extremely limited access into the upper wilderness countries. And so by moving that season into the month of June and getting it into the summer, that opens up access to lots more ground than we've ever had access to, and thus creates a lot more ground to be able to spread out hunters. And then again, on the harvest objective, splitting that up between residents and non-residents, we feel that the precedence has already been set in Idaho, but that is doable, and we could use, I believe that we could mirror or look at Idaho's how they run it and do something similar to that. So, and if it comes down to splitting that up, or if it comes down to keeping them limited entry and doubling the tags, or keeping them harvest objective, we would prefer to keep them harvest objective for the time being, which would give us time to address that Idaho type system in the future. So,
thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Adam Johnson.
Hi, I'm Aaron Johnson with the Utah Houndsman Association. I think Ben touched on a lot of good things, and the first thing I want to say is I really think the division did really good on this proposal, and we're not asking for a lot of major changes or to reject the proposal. We think that by far the vast majority of the proposal is really well written and it stays within the plan. But I am proud that these organizations came together and submitted to you guys a letter, and I also sent an email out to the RACs from the Hound Association that echoes what Ben said. And we think that these are minor changes that can be made that actually make it a better opportunity for all Utah outdoorsmen and will help with their plan. And that's the reason we did that. The Hound Association does have an extra request. And we were concerned about there's four areas that were limited entry last year that are proposed to go into harvest objective this year. And so we've asked you to consider keeping those limited entry. Those areas are the North Slope, South Slope, Book Cliffs, and the Wasatch West. But thanks, Leslie. I think you're doing a great job. Does anyone have any questions for us? Does Bill have any questions?
I didn't. We're good. Sherry Gilmore?
Thank you for giving us this opportunity to voice our opinions on the proposed bear hunts. My name is Sherry Gilmore. I'm from Ogden. According to the Bureau of Economic and Business Research, tourism-related state and local tax revenues totaled $970 million in 2013, with that figure expected to rise at least 10% in 2014. What does this have to do with hunting bears? Well, money talks. I can rhapsodize all day about the magnificence of bears and the need to have them in a healthy ecosystem. I can question the sportsmanship of shooting a bear you have lured to a pile of rotting meat, but the state doesn't absolutely need beauty or ethics to survive. Tax dollars, on the other hand, that we need. My job has required me to travel all over the country, and when coworkers and clients learn I'm from Utah, they all comment on the beauty of our state, and they're either planning a visit or still talking about the last one. All of them, 100%, travel to Utah for the chance to see open spaces and wildlife. They're not coming to see subdivisions or go shopping. They can do that at home. What they can't do at home is have any chance of seeing a bear in the wild. Their states, most of them, long ago wiped out all predators, and these people recognize the loss. We in Utah hold the happy position of being able to retain what makes us Utah. We have the things people crave and will pay to experience. Having a viable bear population is something Utah should promote as one of those things. I have seen people experience the awe and exhilaration of seeing a bear in the wild. It's something they'll never forget, and they will return to the place where it happened, hoping to experience it again. I know I do. $970 million in tax revenue from tourists. That's a lot of money. Maybe some of that could be put into educating people on living with bears instead of going directly to the kill option. When we figured out that driving drunk caused deaths, we set up measures to discourage people from driving drunk. We didn't blow up all the liquor stores. We produced public service announcements showing the results of driving drunk. We put law enforcement out on the roads and gave them the tools to get these drivers off the roads. And there has been a significant drop in drunk driving-related deaths. Could we not put some effort into explaining to people that taking food into tents is not wise, that leaving a dirty campsite is potentially deadly, that they do share this area with other species, and that as the species with superior reasoning skills, they have a responsibility to recognize that and take precautions. Could we not fine people for reckless behavior in bear country? They do it in the national parks. We all know that anything the feds can do, Utah can do better. And I'm not anti-hunter. My dad's been a hunter for 70 years. He would be ashamed to take down such a pinnacle predator with a high-powered rifle camped out over a trash heap. He sure as hell wouldn't call it hunting. We are better than this. We can live here in this most beautiful of states. And we can allow bears to live here too. Thank you.
Thank you. Kirk Robinson.
Kirk Robinson, Western Wildlife Conservancy. First, a couple of observations. I think, you know, I really appreciate the questions of the RAC members. It shows that people here are educated, informed, and concerned about the issues, and not in every case just your own personal issue either. And the other thing is, evidently, the Utah bear population has been growing, whatever the reason. I think that's a good thing on the whole. It might have something to do with the fact that there used to be a lot more livestock grazing in certain areas, and there was a time when poisons were used to kill predators, and perhaps the carrying capacity hadn't been reached in certain areas. Now we have conflicts, in some cases involving other hunters, in other cases involving livestock, and campers and recreationists and so forth. And I'm here to represent a point of view that focuses on what we think is good for bears, not for hunters or houndsmen or recreationists as such. There are other people to focus on those issues. So I really don't care very much if there's a squabble between two hunting factions about who's getting the most time. What concerns me is, I see bears coming out of hibernation that are very vulnerable to being killed. And the first thing that happens is we make it harder for them to get through the summer by attracting them to bait stations and killing them. So what I'm going to do is not make a proposal, but I have a number of concerns that I just want to raise, and they all have to do with how little we know, not how much we know. I think we sometimes forget that we don't really know very much about a lot of things. One thing we don't know, seems to me, is how many cubs are orphaned, how many die because of that. Another thing we don't know is to what extent bears really are habituated to people and food sources. There's a little bit of information, but I've talked with and read literature on this. I've talked with Barry Gilbert. I've read stuff from Tom Beck, who studied bears their whole lives. And there is a concern about this, that, for example, if you're baiting bears, you could habituate the bears to human smells and such. Those bears wander all over the place. They're eventually going to come across campgrounds anyway. And it's just classical conditioning that we learn when we learn from, studying Ivan Pavlov, for example. If they associate human food with human signs, they may be led to investigate. I'm not saying they will. I'm saying we don't know. You don't know. Nobody here really knows very much about that. Another thing is we're feeding those bears. These barrels have thousands and thousands of calories of very nutritious food in them. That's why the bears are attracted. They're not all killed. Some of those bears go away, and they have an advantage through the year going into hibernation if they're females for a number of fetuses that might come to term. And you could actually be increasing the bear population. So if your objective is to reduce it, do we really know that that's what we're going to be doing? Do we really know that we're not going to be causing more problems than we are solving? I suggest we don't really know very much about any of this. And there's one more thing that I want to mention, and it has to do with, darn it, I forgot it. Maybe that's enough. But, it has to do with the education. And I appreciate what Sherry said. We've got more people in Utah, and we have more conflicts in certain places, largely because of more people, not just more bears. And I know the division doesn't have the resources to educate everybody about all the issues and how to avoid conflicts. I think somehow the larger public needs to be enlisted into that project of informing and educating people and making them learn that they have a responsibility not to create conflicts if they can help it. It's just wrong for people to go out and have a house in bear habitat and then act like they live downtown Bountiful or something, where there aren't any bears. and then expect somebody else to solve the problem for them when a bear comes into their hamburger grill or whatever it is. So I'd like to see us work together to figure out more ways that we can help to prevent problems in the first place. One last thing, if I have any time left. You know, I'll make it very quick. If we're going to have continue to extend seasons here, then I say let's reduce the number of permits or some other way to compensate. You saw what that graph showed. And despite the fact that the triangles were up very high, still the number of bears killed has gone steadily up for a long time. And that does cause me some concern. Thank you.
Thank you. Buzz Marth Arler?
Buzz Marth Arler. I'm speaking for the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Northern Utah. And first thing I'd like to say is, as chairman, I feel comfortable that I can endorse Sherry's approach. It's exactly what we'd love to see. But aside from that, education, again, is very important. And Mr. Cabot, you asked about, you know, the need for being annual. 28 years in the United States Air Force, I asked the same question for the first half of my career because it seemed stupid. I was given safety briefings constantly throughout the year and CPR training constantly, but as I became a supervisor, I realized the need and understood it, and familiarity helps to prevent ignorance. And making these people do that every year, I think, is a really good idea. I'd rather not see the permits go up. I'd like to see Wildlife Services continue to do that ugly job that they do and target the animals that are depredation animals. With the education, hopefully lowering depredation issues, and then Wildlife Services doing their job, and then the hunters, of course, do their take. I have a question that obviously this is a question period, so I'm going to state it and not expect an answer, but I've been thinking while I'm listening to this about the use of hounds in pursuit in these heavy depredation areas. They get the act or more bears in these areas to go after, and maybe over years these bears, they aren't stupid. They might learn to, we might see fewer of them coming into these areas because they know that they're going to be constantly harassed by hounds. Again, I don't really like that harassment, but it might help and alleviate some of the issues with depredation. Those are my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lee Tracy?
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. I won't speak to the proposal, although we do support it. But what I will speak to is the issue about the conflict between the houndsmen and the bait hunters and the spot and stalkers. Notice on that list of groups that propose this thing that we have hunters from both ends. I suspect that most of the bow hunters are hunting from tree stands over bait, and certainly the houndsmen are hunting with their hounds. I do know that United Wildlife Cooperative has both kinds of hunters in our group, and I suspect that Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife do as well. What we plan on doing, and I suspect the other groups are planning on doing, is orienting our hunters to this particular issue, to this particular conflict. And last night in the Central RAC meeting, I suggested to Leslie that the Division of Wildlife Resource include that in a heavy way in their orientation so that those conflicts will be part of the ethics program in that orientation. Thanks.
And Lee, your comment that you support the proposal is that you support the UBA proposal.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Brett Salmon.
My name's Brett Salmon. Tonight I'm
I'm speaking in behalf of Farm Bureau. That's the hat I'm wearing tonight. They was unable to come, and they asked me as a member to speak in support of this proposal. Just a little background. We have, we're sheep ranchers here in northern Utah and on the Grays River in Wyoming. We have bear issues here as well as up there. In Wyoming, we've had years where there was many bears and many problems, and they coincided with the years when we had a poor feed year. So the bears came into the sheep on a poor feed year. We've had years such as this year where we had many bears and few problems because we had a good feed year. So we need to try and y'all are doing that. You're trying to address those issues to keep this population in check, and I applaud the division for what they're doing. Wildlife Services is understaffed. They can't come to the livestock producers as we need them, as often as we need them. Utah's compensation program is on confirmed losses, whereas Wyoming has a multiplier that pays us for our actual losses. We only find a third of the losses that we actually have. So it's important that we get these bears in control, and that's what the division is trying to do. So anyway, myself and speaking for Farm Bureau, then we support this proposal.
Brett, for clarification, you support the division's presentation?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Troy Justinson.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. You know, I agree with Sherry what she spoke in a lot of things there. Utah is a unique place. We have wildlife and the opportunity to view wildlife and enjoy it second to none. And I think we ought to be more involved in education, and especially those tourists who come to the state, and help them to realize that a lot of the opportunity they have to view wildlife is because of sportsmen and sportsmen's dollars. It's our monies that we put in to protect these species, to grow them, to make them in abundance, not only for us to enjoy the heritage that we have as hunters, fishermen, and conservationists, but those who choose not to participate and are non-consumptive. We welcome them to that. But don't try to restrict what we do, especially when we consider ourselves the stewards that are willing to put our money where our mouth is. Now, speaking to the bear proposal, we support the recommendation that is made by Yuba. And I think there's a lot of misconception when it comes to bait. It's not as easy as it sounds. You don't go set a box of donuts out, sit there, and the bear comes in. I've tried that. I eat most of the donuts before the bear comes in, as represented by my physique. But one of the concerns is, from the other side, is that the sows and cubs are going to be shot and mistaken. Quite frankly, baiting provides a better opportunity to identify a lactating sow. I would put it right there with hounds, of being able to view a bear in a tree and see if she has cubs, versus spot and stalk when the foliage is high. A lot of times those cubs aren't with her. And one thing you also need to remember, when it does come to baiting, most of the time a bait station is accompanied by a trail camera. Those cubs will come in with her. And as hunters prepare and have that bait station there, that sow is going to be in there, and she's going to be caught on a camera. And they identify and say, even if she does come in, they can identify and know that she does have cubs. So quite frankly, I think it will work in the controversy and actually help from bears and sows not being harvested. We appreciate all that you've done, Leslie. We appreciate the division. We appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight and address you. Thank you.
Thank you. I do have one additional comment card on this topic. John Young wished not to speak. I think it was John. With the wool growers, did not wish to speak, but he wrote he supported the recommendation. So if he's here, I'd like to get a clarification that he supports the division's recommendation. Okay, he indicates yes. Thank you. And that's all the blue cards I have on this topic. Is there anyone additional public that wants to comment? Seeing none, we'll go to the council for comments. I would like to get just a couple of clarifications. Leslie, I believe recent court decisions have found that the state is not exempt from certain legal obligations as far as bears in the state, right?
Yes.
So we've become responsible, or the state's become responsible for some damages for things that happened.
When we respond on an incident, we assume liability.
Okay. Previously, our legal staff did advise us we couldn't treat non-residents differently than residents in certain ways. Was
correct.
That correct?
Because correct. We have been sued in the past for not allowing non-residents to pursue in Utah with hounds. And I met with Marty specifically on this issue this morning and asked if we would be violating that same thing again. And he indicated that we would be if we treated them differently.
Okay. Are there bear units that are changing from limited entry to harvest objective, and is that because of predator management plans?
Yes. It's not because of predator management. It was because of the level of livestock and nuisance.
So they're changing based upon the levels we set in our management plan?
Correct.
Okay. Additional comments or from the council? Jim.
Well, I just want to say that the division has done a great deal in educating campers. You can't go very far into the outdoors without running across this is bear country signs, and I think they've made a great effort to educate the public on the bear situation. They can't make anybody put their food in a protected area, but they've done a good job, I think, of educating. I also want to note that we had a great increase in the number of permits, and we had a relatively significant increase in the number of bears taken, and yet the number of bears statewide continues to increase, and it just reinforces to me what I've always thought, and that is that we don't do a real good job of managing animals. We do a pretty good job of managing people, and that's really what we're here for.
Jeffrey.
Well, I don't know if any of our council members are going to make a motion to accept the Bowman's proposal, but I do want to make a comment on one portion of it, and that is the mirroring the LaSalle and the San Juans with the rest of the season. It just seems to me that this is a public resource, and just because somebody paid a lot of money or waited a lot of time, it doesn't seem to me fair to give them special treatment and special regulations in a particular area just because they're getting special treatment. I think, hey, you pays your money, you takes your chances.
Bryce?
I would agree with him on that. And, you know, I agree with them on their recommendations on, you know, the overlap. I think it's pretty cool that we have four groups. How often do you see four groups come together, you know, to make a recommendation? I think that's pretty cool in itself. And, you know, take their time and think it out and present it. And I hope we take that into consideration because I think they're all great ideas.
Jeffrey, could you maybe help me with your statement that you would favor the seasons being extended or not favor the seasons being extended on the Los Salles and the San Juan.
I was talking about making special regulations to avoid conflicts between limited entry elk hunters versus some bear hunters out there, and to make special regulations and special dates just to try to keep these a guy that finally drew out for his limited elk permit so he doesn't have to run into a guy hunting a bear just seems silly to me and not fair to the other person that should have just as much opportunity to hunt a publicly owned resource like a bear or a bobcat or a deer or anything else. It just doesn't seem fair to give them special treatment because they paid a lot of money or they waited a lot of time.
All right. Jim? I see you reaching for the microphone.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about how to respond. We give special treatment to everybody, and we have a special good times for bow hunters and good times for muzzleloader hunters, and I really do think that if there's a situation that we can avoid, reasonably avoid a conflict, and I think this is a reasonable avoidance attempt, then I think we should take it, and if it inconveniences one or the other, then that's better than I've done a few homicide investigations. I don't want to have to get involved in any more.
Craig?
Yes, I'd like to take this opportunity and just thank the division for making the recommendation that any legal weapon can be used in harvesting a bear over bait.
Paul?
So Leslie, let's say that we go ahead and implement the division's proposal with the great number of changes, and we end up dropping the number of bears down significantly. How are we going to identify which of the many tools that were put in place this round really was the effective tool?
So we, like I said, we do check in every bear that's harvested, and we can tie it back to how it was harvested and when it was harvested and all of those. And so that will be our evaluation.
Okay, thank you.
And that is why we asked at the end of this that we have, that we will evaluate this at the end of the year to make sure we weren't too drastic on any way.
It seems like we've got, at least from my view, if you're trying to test a hypothesis, to test it with four different methods at one time really isn't a very sharp way to go. However, it may accomplish the objective of dropping the bear numbers.
Well, we do, to respond to that, we do have long trend history over the limited entry fall season. We've got the first 3 years of the spring season, and so we can go back and compare how we've altered things and where that change occurred.
Yeah, I guess what I'm looking at, though, is we've got a new season in the summer now. With your, if that proposal were to be recommended and passed by the board, we do have multiple, a variety of weapons over bait now, which is a change.
We'll be looking closely at the success rate of the different methods and evaluating if it, which one worked for, and if we saw a decrease in the nuisance. I mean, we will be looking at it closely.
Jim or John?
I'd like to make a motion that we accept division proposal as presented, with exception that we would include the first two recommendations made by Yuba and the other groups represented here.
Is there a second? John Wall? Okay, we have a motion from John Leonard and a second from John Wall to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the 2015 Black Bear recommendations and rule amendments as presented, including the first two items on the Yuba proposal, which would be to set the summer season dates to May 23rd to July 2nd and set the San Juan and La Salle dates to mirror the rest of the state. Discussion on the motion. Jeffrey.
Just a comment. I think that's a good compromise. You picked the two best two, and I like them both. I like it.
Bryce?
Especially if we think that there might be an issue with the Attorney General on the one, so it'd be nice to avoid that one. So,
any additional discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
10 in favor. Opposed? 2. Motion passes. Did we have an abstention? You voted opposed, correct?
I did oppose,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, there was no abstention.
Do you want to
Paul,
know
you
why?
Paul, you voted in favor, correct?
That's correct.
I counted him in favor. Okay, we'll now move on to Wolf Management Plan Extensions.
Doesn't Jim get to say why?
Yeah, typically you ask us why we oppose. You don't have to, but
no,
I typically do.
No, keep me in line. Then I will be compliant. Would you like to voice the reason for your opposition?
I like the division's proposal, particularly with the San Juan and LaSalle dates. I just think that would result in fewer conflicts and not hurt either side very much. I'm more or less neutral on the summer season, but the San Juan and LaSalle fall dates, I like the division's proposal, so that's why I voted against it.
Same. I think if we know we have a conflict, I think we're obligated to try and remedy the situation.
Thank you, gentlemen. Go ahead, Leslie.
I'm the next. You're not done with me yet, so.
Yes, I know, Wolf.
Okay, so I'm going to start this out by saying we're not making any changes to the plan. This is only a request for an extension of our current plan. So current legal status of wolves. Wolves are delisted in a small portion of northern Utah, which is north of I-80. It includes Rich, Summit, part of Summit, part of Morgan County. Outside of that area, wolves are still protected by the Endangered Species Act, and management falls to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. State law directs the division to prevent the establishment of wolves in any delisted areas of the state until the entire state is delisted. If wolves do occur in any of the listed areas, we are to request the service to come and remove those. Currently, wolves are proposed for delisting range-wide, but because of conflicts, legal, it still hasn't happened. So we're just anticipating that that will happen. And our plan here in our state does not take effect until wolves are delisted statewide. The biological status of wolves in Utah, we have confirmed around 13 individual wolves over the past 10 years. Almost all have occurred in counties bordering Wyoming and Idaho, and there is currently no evidence of breeding activity in our state. This is the male wolf that was spotted in the Uintas this fall. It had a radio collar that corresponded with the boundary pack in Idaho on the boundary with Canada. We have not located that animal since I think it was the end of September, first part of October. We don't know if the collar went dead or if it's moved on, but we have not had any sightings since that time. Our current plan was passed by the Wildlife Board. It went through the public process. It took 2 years to create. So we're not requesting any changes to that plan. It was passed for a 10-year period. It will expire December 31st. The legislature did ask us to put a plan in place. It's never gone into effect. And so based on the current legal and biological status, we're recommending extending the current wolf plan for another 5 years in anticipation that they will be delisted. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the public on the presentation?
Buzz Marthaler. So are you saying that if it they become federally delisted, that we would then write a new plan at that time?
No, this plan would go into effect. Right now we can't use this plan until they are delisted. So right now, because they're listed, they fall under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have no management authority over them. If they become delisted, then we would have management authority over them, and the plan would become active.
Okay. And maybe you can help me with the background of this. Is this strictly based on ranchers having issues with wolves being in Utah?
What do you mean, the plan?
Yeah, the plan. I mean, basically, it's a no wolves are welcome in Utah plan.
No, it isn't. It does allow the establishment. It calls for recovery of establishment of two breeding pairs of wolves, and that's a minimum of two. It's not only two. And then at that time, it does allow establishment of wolves.
Two wolf packs?
Two breeding pairs, a minimum, and that's what's considered recovery. So you can have more than that, but when you hit two, then it's considered recovery.
Okay. And when would the next management plan be looked at?
When this one expires in 2005, or 5 years from now.
2020.
So we're trying to just keep it in place without having to go form a whole board and rework it all. It took 2 years to get this one in place.
Thank you.
Any additional questions from the public? Seeing none, questions from the council? Okay, we'll go to comment cards. Kirk, you said you possibly wanted to comment. Do you wish to comment?
No.
Thank you. Buzz, do you wish to comment?
Yes. Yes, Buzz Marthaler, Wildlife Rehabilitation Center, Northern Utah. I just would like to make the comment that I believe that Utah is a predator-unfriendly state, and I'd like to see a little more welcoming signs to allow these predators, bears and wolves, to do what they do. Utah is a perfect state. It is the premium corridor state for all the states that surround us when it comes to wolves, whether they be Mexican or the gray, and I would really like to see in the future to see that be implemented in our plan, because two in a state this large just seems a little small for me. It is minimum, I understand that.
Right, and that's a minimum, and we were a corridor recently for Arizona.
All right, thank you.
That's all the blue cards I have. Is there anyone else from the public who'd wish to comment on this item? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Comments and or motions if no one wishes to comment. Paul?
Leslie, I wonder, at least with this plan, I understand that we're just trying to roll it over to the next 5 years. I'm wondering why, though, we wouldn't attach an amendment to that to say, here's what's happened over the last 5 years for wolves in the state of Utah and provide that history there.
We have the history. It's not attached to the plan. If we start messing with any of the wording in the plan, we're opening the plan up through the public process, and we don't want to do that at this time. So we have the history. It doesn't need to be part of the plan itself, and we can attach it as an amendment any other time, but we do not want to. If we start changing the wording and the verbiage in the plan, then we're opening it up, and we don't want to open it up without reforming a group. And it took us 2 years to get where we're at, so we don't want to mess with it. We would just rather extend the plan and keep it in place because it had good concepts and where we wanted to go with it.
So how would the public get access to that history?
We have it printed up. It's on our website. Okay. It's available.
I'd like to make a motion that we approve the proposal as presented.
Second.
I'm going to take Price. We have a motion from Joel Ferry and a second from Bryce Thurgood to recommend the Wildlife Board approve the Wolf Management Plan extension as presented. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
It's unanimous. Thank you very much, Leslie.
Thank you.
So we'll go to item number 8, R657-55, Convention Permit Rule Amendments.
Mr. Chairman, Kenny Johnson, Admin Services Chief in Salt Lake City. I'm a little tiny bit offended that all those Aggies left before the, we got a couple left. Nice job. I was going to encourage them to stay in school, become administrators, show up here and help us do some of this heavy lifting. Okay, sorry. I'll get serious. Okay, so Admin Services Chief, thank you, Mr. Chairman, RAC members, members of the public for supporting your process. This is a good exercise. We appreciate the support. Let me start this one really quick by stating we value tremendously all of our conservation partners. The division has countless partners who are passionate, who care about wildlife, who want to participate, want to help, want to do good things for wildlife. And the convention is kind of an extension of that. And so it's a valuable asset to us and a big deal for us. And so we support it now with the current situation. We support this thing moving forward and what it brings to Utah. And so what we're talking about tonight, a couple changes to the R657-55 rule. I'll give you a really quick history of it. This was adopted originally in 2005. And what the convention did is it provided 200 limited entry permits of various species to be issued at a convention held in Utah. Had to attract at least 10,000 attendees, and then the permits were available to a conservation group who demonstrated the ability to protect wildlife and help wildlife species in Utah. The permits are issued through a $5 random draw process. We kind of monitor that, make sure it's all above board, and that's kind of the way it got started. These permits have typically been approved and contracted for 5 years at a time. The Wildlife Board every year gets a new set of these, any changes that happen year by year, and they actually approve and allocate those permits on an annual basis. They are taken from those permits that are used from our traditional public drawing, so the 200 do come out of there. The current status, 2016 will complete our second five-year contract. In late 2012, there was a meeting to amend the contract that began in 2013, specifying that the contractor, whoever had the contract for these permits, retain only the same portion of the $5 application fee that we allowed our big game draw contractor, which happens to be in Nevada. And so tonight we're going to talk about a couple of those changes that were made as amendments and incorporate them into the rule. The remaining funds of those $5 application fees were to be used for projects approved by the division director in writing, and the funds had to be committed or spent by September 1st, 2 years following when they were collected. So let's just jump into the changes. There's three. They're pretty straightforward, so the rest of this presentation will be quick. What we're going to do is propose that we rename the rule from convention to expo. And the real reason is it just kind of separates the identity and clarifies that a little bit better. We have conservation permit programs and conservation permit things, and a lot of times those two terms will get tangled up. And so we're trying to make the identity a little bit clearer for everybody to understand, and we think that'll remove some of the public confusion with these. Making that change impacted seven other rules. So we refer back in these rules on this slide. We refer to the convention in each one of these rules. So kind of as a housekeeping item, we will go into each of these seven rules. Anywhere we see the word or term convention, we'll replace that with expo. And we just wanted to give you guys an idea of what the changes would be, and these rules will be changed if this proposal passes. Okay. So, really quick on this next change. So you guys are going second, and these RAC processes are kind of a work in progress. We learn things as we go, and last night going first, I recognize I hadn't done a very good job in explaining in this rule how we wanted this next change to work. And so what we're proposing is that we want to allow the conservation organization named in the Expo contract the opportunity to extend up to 5 additional years upon mutual agreement of the division, the group, and approval of the Wildlife Board. And we wanted to clarify that next bullet down wasn't there last night. And this will be for contracts awarded after the 2016 one expires. So not the current incumbent. It'll be everybody after 2016. The final proposed change tonight, we just want to formalize in rule that piece that was amended in 2013 that said this contractor could retain the same portion of revenue that our draw contractor does, and kind of disassociate those two. They're completely apples and oranges. It was a convenient place to land years ago and seemed fair, but we want to allow them to retain specifically $3.50 per application, and that will set at $1.50 the remaining amount for specific wildlife conservation-related projects. We think that brings some transparency to these funds, and we just want to discontinue the reference to the division draw contract because they're just night and day. There's no real comparison. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny. Do we have any questions from the public on the presentation? Please come up to mic.
Troy Jessison, Sportsman, Fish, and Wildlife. Can you give me the total dollar number that's paid to Fallon to have them manage your draw process?
Yes, that contract is about $1.5 million.
Just a
shade under that. Yep.
All right. Do you guys perform an audit to see where they spend that $1.5 million? You pay them to do that?
What we do is we make sure. On an annual basis, we renegotiate that contract based on what we think applications are going to do. So one of my functions is to make sure that the services they provide are covered by that $1.5 million. And so we don't know specifically who exactly they're employing or what they're paying oftentimes, but we know and negotiate the $1.5 for the half a million or so applications they handle for us, and then all the extracurricular stuff that goes with it.
Of that $1.5 million, is there any money that comes back to Utah to benefit wildlife and conservation?
Well, it depends. I mean, it starts to get to some gray areas because it's a service contract, and the service they provide us is invaluable to keeping bonus points straight, preference points straight, sending out letters, sending out notifications.
No, what I'm talking about is specific dollars sent to the division to pay for a specific project or anything like that?
No, not with those funds. But the additional part of the application revenue generates quite a bit of...
Which is held by the division.
For the division, sure.
Correct. All right. Does Fallon Nevada provide any economical advantages or income to the state through the service they provide? I mean, do they employ people here within the state? Do they attract tourism to the state through the function they provide?
That's a good question. It's loaded. There's no direct correlation, but we have contract monitors hired in Salt Lake City who make sure they do what we need them to do to meet the obligations of the contract. They reciprocate, but yeah, they don't have an office here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Any additional questions from the public on the presentation? Seeing none, we'll go to the council. Kenny, at what point in the, say, So the current contract will be expire in 2016, is that correct?
After the 2016 convention, yep, or and expo, sorry.
Okay, and then have you thought about awarding the contract in advance so that it allows the organization to have some time to do their planning?
The timing's outlined in the rule. It would give them essentially a half a year. So that one's going to expire. There will be a new RFP for 2017, and that timeline's about May.
But that's a very short time period for someone to actually do planning if there was going to be a change or to be able to tell your backers or somebody that, yes, I'm going to have this contract and we're good to rent the Salt Palace or to do something in advance. Has there been any discussion about trying to enlarge that window to allow for more planning?
It's a fair question. I don't know that we've discussed that specifically, but I mean, it's eight, 9 months?
It's pretty short when you're actually reserving space.
Yeah.
Basically, the people that have the contract now are probably on the hook for the space contractually in advance. So that was just my question.
That's a fair question.
Okay. Any additional questions from the council? Paul?
I'm trying to understand, as far as the $3.50 for each draw voucher, what benefit the public's seeing from that $3.50, given that there are no preference points. I'm thinking complexity. It doesn't seem like there's any preference points to track. It seems pretty straightforward and should be quite a bit cheaper than the normal tracking that's done for the rest of the system.
Yeah, that's a fair question as well. And it's really not just for administering the draw. It's admin expenses for the whole entire expo. We believe in it enough to agree to that amount. And so when we look at cost benefit, the benefits to the division, to our shared missions, to recruiting, retaining, reactivating, and keeping relevant kind of all of our heritage, it's a benefit. We think that's where the benefit is.
Okay, thank you.
Bryce.
You said last night you had some questions on how you didn't have the 2016 in there. Was people thinking they were getting it for 10 years and not 5? Or what was the confusion?
As I understood it, it was kind of a thought that the incumbent, the current contractor, could just apply for that now and re-up. And that wasn't our intent. We wanted to go out on RFP again. And then any contract after 2016, let them apply for an extension.
Because I think we had a few emails. I don't know if you guys seen them, that people thought that...
We've had a lot of emails.
Well, and a lot of them said that. Uh-huh. So I think that was part of their confusion, too.
Yeah, so we wanted to clarify that, make sure we're actually going to modify the rule to put the date, the hard date in there of 2016. So that's the plan.
Okay. Chris.
Kenny, you just gave a pretty strong endorsement of the possible benefits of that $350 per application for the state of Utah. Have you specifically tried to quantify what those benefits are so that you can say, this is, we sketched it out, this is what we think the benefits are to our state, to the $350 going to the conservation organization?
You know, to quantify, I've heard different numbers, and the groups can probably speak more specifically to what the big numbers are, but to the state, the number we hear is it's $10 million plus boon to the local economy, which is kind of neither here nor there for us, but it's a big deal. It's a lot of money. For us, it's more the focusing event. It puts a spotlight directly on wildlife issues in Utah, and we support that. And we think there's a good symbiotic relationship with that draw and our draw happening, you know, kind of in those couple down winter months. And so that's probably the big thing, is it just generates some excitement for wildlife at kind of an off time of year. So
Kenny, there was legislative action to allow this to happen, and I believe their intent was to for economic development and what you're talking about, focusing on wildlife. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. John Leonard.
We all received a lot of emails concerning accountability and whether or not, I guess, it was being tracked correctly and used for the identified purpose. Do you feel comfortable that you have adequate safeguards in place to account for that money? And I understand now it can't be commingled with other Expo dollars. It has to be kept in a separate account.
That's correct. Yes, our office does an audit, kind of top to bottom of the whole thing, from looking at the database to the programming, all the ancillary stuff with the draw itself, and then we do a review of their bank records to make sure those funds aren't commingled. We check amounts, make sure they're spot on, and they've been very, very clean and succinct to this point. So, yes. Okay.
Jim Gaskell.
So, just so I'm clear, in 2016, there'll be another bid process, if you will, and that will be for a contract for how long?
That will be for a 5-year contract, and then whoever wins that one would have that option with the board, the division, and the group to possibly extend that, to apply for an extension.
So that would be a 10-year ultimate?
Could be. That only awarded as a 5-year, but up to,
awarded,
up to
awarded
five
for
more.
Five, but it's the burden of proof kind of shifts here at the end of 5 years. Someone else who wants to bid may not have the advantage of those of the group that already has the bid. That would be the purpose of this thing, right? So they apply for a 5-year extension, and that, in essence, eliminates the competition, if there is any.
You could look at it that way. You could also look at it that if it's a good thing, it will continue. So,
sure, but it would continue if it was a good thing anyway, right?
Sure.
If they're the best bidder, they would win the next 5 years, correct?
Yeah.
And how many bidders do we usually have?
It's a good question. I don't remember 06 what it looked like then or the last one. So
seems like we had one. I may be wrong, but that's my memory.
Could have been. I'll research that and figure
yeah,
it out.
Yeah, that's okay. You don't need to okay. research that. I just think there's not. It's not like there's a big long line of people submitting bids. Is that correct?
Yes.
Any additional questions from the council? Seeing none, we're going to go to blue cards. Lee Tracy.
Lee Tracy, United Wildlife Cooperative. I sent you gentlemen and ladies an email, and I'm just going to read that for the benefit of the audience as well. This email is in regards to the current proposal to change the Convention Expo permit program. Regrettably, the United Wildlife Cooperative cannot support this proposal as written. First, let it be known that we have no desire to discredit nor hamper the Hunting Expo nor the promoters. It is a world-class event that we are happy to have in our backyard, and we want it to continue. We also realize it is a major undertaking and commend the Mule Deer Foundation and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife for their hard work these many years. The only issues we have with this ongoing project are regarding the use and auditing of the funds derived from the $5 application fees charged for the convention permit draw and the trilateral extension of the DWR-MDF-SFW contract. Because those permits are taken out of the public quota, we consider those application fees as public funds that require or should require some mandates as to their use and an independent in-depth audit rather than just a financial report. And while the DWR proposal does not mandate that a portion of these funds be returned to wildlife, does mandate that a portion of these funds be returned to wildlife and the DWR, that's 30%. We believe that the portion returned is not sufficient and needs to be closer to, if not equal to, the portion returned in the convention permit program. By way of information, on October the 16th, United Wildlife Cooperative was the one that initially made this proposal. We made a presentation, and our goal at that time was to convert this convention permit program into a similar program as the conservation or the auction program. As we understand it, the $3.50 portion per application retained by the promoters was derived simply as a figure equal to the current cost of the public drawing done by Systems Consultants of Fallon, Nevada, with little or no regard for the services rendered. And the claim that the expo drawing services are equal to the public drawing services is not substantiated when the two drawings are compared side by side. For instance, the following are some of the tasks that Systems Consultants perform that MDF and SFW do not. Prepare a reminder database for all DWR hunt applications, over 182,000. Print and mail upcoming drawing reminder postcards, 182,000. Shift and staff and maintain 800 information phone lines and one fax line, 24/7, from January 30th to December the 11th. That's 11 months, round the clock. Conduct the drawing distribution, which includes separating lifetime license holders, dedicated hunters, youth, residents and non-residents, group applications, bonus points, preference points, waiting period, and up to five choices. Send out result letters and emails to all applicants. Print and send out permits. Print and send out survey reminder letters and emails. And conduct the survey, by the way. There are also other items that require phone follow-up on credit cards, incorrect applications, and after-hunt surveys. And all of this is done, and more, is currently done by Systems Consultants for $3.01 per application, and that includes their profit. Bottom line, the drawings are not similar. Additionally, per the financial report, the expenses claimed to be exclusive to the drawing include many expenses that pertain to the expo as well, and or are too generic to identify, and we believe should be paid from expo funds and not from permit application funds. Well, gentlemen, you can read the rest of that. In essence, we believe that those changes would be more compatible. Our recommended changes would be more compatible to the mission of the expo and would be acceptable to the public. Thanks.
Thank you, Lee. And your recommendation is that it would be inverted. 70% would come to the division and 30% would be retained in your email.
That is, just flip those percentages.
Yes. All right. Might be John Larson.
Mr. Chair and in the committee members, it's great to be here with you tonight. My name is John Larson, representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. On behalf of the Expo and its partners, we accept the recommendations based on what Kenny has provided tonight. And in addition to that, I just want to spend a few minutes and try and do the best I can to educate you, at least give it a good shot, on what this expo does for the state of Utah in two regards. And Kenny's alluded to them a little bit. One is, well, let me share a thought with you. In 2009, and I'm fairly new to the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife group, but I've always partnered with them from a retail perspective in sponsoring the expo. But in 2009, both the SFW group and Mule Deer the Mueller Foundation, partnered with University of Utah to come up with the Bieber Report, which is the Bureau of Economic and Business Report or Research. And what we found out from that is that we're trying to figure out the impact, the economic impact to the state. And in 2009, that economic impact was a big one. It was roughly $8.5 million. That's a big deal. That's revenue generated to the state. Certainly not the contractors, but to the state. That was in 2009. We figure now that's more like the numbers you were throwing out earlier, probably more in the range of $10 to $11 million coming into the state. In 2009, there was 105 jobs created. I'm sure it's not double that, but it's probably close to nowadays, which is a big deal. And I can speak specifically to that. You know, again, like I said, I've been with SFW for 2 months. Prior to that, my entire professional career, which is 20 years, was all spent in the service sector, specifically specialty retail, with a couple groups that you'll know, Sportsman's Warehouse and Cabela's. I worked for both of those organizations for some time. And I can tell you, it's interesting, every time the Expo would operate, the last 10 years, both in Utah and in the surrounding states where we had stores in operation, there's always a spike in top-line sales that week and the following weeks due to residual income based on the marketing efforts that we put into it. So that's not even included in what that research report found. So it's in addition to, which is a big deal for the state. So again, bottom line, the economic value to the state that the Expo brings, it's a big deal, and it's a great win for the state. The second point that I want to bring up is the money that's used to enhance Utah's wildlife. And at the end of the day, that's really what it's all about. That's why the Expo was even created. That's why we do the permits the way we do, the conservation permits, the $5 application fee. That's a process. But there's a fee to running an Expo like that. Can I just ask, raise of hand, who in this room has been to the Expo? Probably all of you. It's a big show. It takes a lot of preparation to get that thing running. Robert, you asked a great question. I think it was Robert, maybe John. Your question was, is there enough time when that contract goes to the next provider, do they have time to do it? I would tell you they don't. We're 9 years into this. I've sat in two planning Expo planning meetings with joint meetings between SFW and the Mueller Foundation, and it's amazing to me, 9 years into it, the amount of massaging that still goes into developing those relationships, retaining those relationships to get these vendors to come back and feel good. It is absolutely a business, and it requires a lot of attention. To that point, though, I want to educate you a little bit about what the funds do and where we put those funds. In 2012, we started a pheasant habitat project in conjunction with the division. It's been ongoing for 3 years now, and in that program, the last 3 years, SFW has spent $180,000 of its money, operating cash, actually more like $200,000. I'm wrong there, to plant roughly 36,000 pheasants across the state. We did that for three reasons. One, to get the youth involved, get them off the couch, get them in the fields with their dad or their cousin or their brothers or uncles or a neighbor if they don't have one of those. And that's happened. Two, to get the public interested in hunting pheasants again following a two-decade decline in pheasant habitat in this state. When I grew up, that was my favorite hunt, the pheasant hunt, and it's just gone away in this state. But it's slowly coming back, and I think you'll see that. We're committed to continuing that process. And three, the third reason there, I'll be quick here. SFW experimented raising our own birds to help augment wild populations and bolster natural reproduction once released. That, again, is ongoing. It doesn't just stop. We have to be committed to that. But that's just one area where those funds go. Real quick here, I know we're in a time crunch here. As far as big game, 2013-2014, the Mueller Translocation Project, we partnered with Brigham Young University and the division to move 300 mule deer off the Parowan Front and off Antelope Island to two other units in the state. And it was a success. And as a result of that, this is the interesting thing I want to share with you. There's two other areas in the country now that are following our pilot program, New Mexico and British Columbia. So we're literally modeling the way of how we transplant. Later this month, there will be more mule deer transplants, a pronghorn transplant, bighorn sheep transplants, all of those things. They all stem from the funds raised at that conservation expo. It's an amazing feat. It's a great thing. We appreciate it. It does two things for the state. It brings economic value to the state, and it enhances our wildlife, and we're lucky for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Brandon Plant? Maybe I got it right.
You did. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and the Council, I appreciate for the opportunity to be here and share some of my thoughts. I hope to bring a unique perspective and more informational. I've had the privilege of being part of the expo in a volunteer capacity for the past 4 years. I've also had the opportunity and was lucky enough to draw a tag. From my perspective as a volunteer, I've seen many of you, and maybe you've seen me work the application booth of the $5 tags, where people will come the day of the expo and fill out and select their choices. And maybe you haven't had the opportunity that I have to hear some of the feedback. People are grateful for the opportunity. There are people in waiting periods that weren't able to apply for a bighorn sheep, a moose tag, an elk tag. There are people that have 20 points for elk, but have missed out on an opportunity or a chance to hunt a deer. And this is providing that opportunity to them. Those lucky few that are successful enough to draw a tag are given an opportunity that they probably wouldn't have. I'm late to hunting myself. I just started hunting 10 years ago. So the opportunity to draw an elk tag in a premium unit with Point Creek may have been limited unless you're very, very lucky. And some people are. I was lucky enough to have drawn a elk tag in a limited entry unit and had an opportunity to hunt an elk and be part of conservation that I wouldn't have to if the expo wasn't there. So my argument, and I would like to support the expo, is that it does provide opportunity and it does bring people from out of state. There are many people at the same application booth. This is my first time to Utah. I flew in today to attend the expo, because I have to be here in person to draw that tag and to verify that I put in. So we're not only bringing Utahns together, but we're bringing people from out of state, and we're putting our best face forward through volunteers and through organization. That's why I think it's so important that we continue that rich heritage that we've already started in putting our best forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Ben Louder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Louder, representing the Utah Bowman's Association. There's been a lot of good said about the expo already. I have a hard time really adding much to it. It's a fun event. I enjoy it every year. My organization has a booth there every year. And we support the division's recommendations as presented. One thing that I think that I can add that I don't think has been touched on yet, one thing that I have noticed as I've attended the expo, as I'm sure all of you know, there's several conservation tags that are sold at that expo during their Friday and Saturday night banquets at auction, and also their Friday day banquet. I have seen those tags sell for much higher amounts at that expo than they would at other local banquets around the state. And so that right there is an additional proof as to how much more money is brought into the state and brought into wildlife conservation programs that goes directly onto the ground here in Utah to support our wildlife. So again, we support the recommendation that's presented. Thank you.
Thank you. Troy?
Troy Justinson, representing myself. Just speaking a little bit to what Lee said, this was not an attempt to pull the wool over people's eyes and to award the current contractor with an additional 5 years. Quite frankly, if UWC wins the award, they apply for it in 2016, I think they need the opportunity to extend for 5 years. Nobody knows what goes into building this thing and making it to the point it is today unless you're involved in it. It takes planning. It takes time. You've got to book the Salt Palace 2 and 3 years in advance in order to get the dates you need. So that's really kind of the whole purpose of it, to make it worthwhile for whoever the contractor is to invest the time and money to make it a successful event. Now speaking to the money that is retained, I think it's quite obvious we pay $1.5 million to Fallon, Nevada, and receive zero benefit to the state of Utah versus jobs, economical income, and wildlife. I can say honestly, standing here before you, it says right there $3.50 goes to overhead. 100% of the money we raise stays here in the state of Utah. 100% of the money we spend goes to wildlife conservation. Now, it may be in one form or another. Some of the money may be going into projects like John outlined. Some of the projects he didn't mention was we spent $27,000 to clean out 22 ponds down on the San Juan. This benefited livestock. This benefited wildlife. We spent $12,500 to put up flashing signs to make motorists aware of deer migration between Monticello and Blandy. They kill over, 1,500 deer there in a two-year period. We're willing once again to put our money where our mouth is, and we show it by what we do. Quite frankly, it all boils down to semantics, and I know the opposition is saying, hey, wait a minute, we want the money you generate through applications to be held separately. That's fine. Quite frankly, it's just a matter of what line you put it in, because we could say, all right, we funded everything in this line through the application fee. We took everything we raised through banquets, and that paid our overhead. Bottom line is this: the more money that we bring in as SFW, the more money that allows us to go out and affect wildlife within the state of Utah and hopefully provide a benefit to the average Joe. We support the division's recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all the blue cards I have for this agenda item. Is there anyone else from the public who'd wish to comment? See none. We'll go to the council. Comments from the council? John Leonard?
I was involved in the initial planning for 3 years prior to the first expo event, and I represented the National Wild Turkey Federation. There were going to be five conservation organizations that were going to partner to run the expo. Huge undertaking, tremendous amount of risk, and the convention tags helped alleviate the risk and the burden of coming together and putting on an event that large. These are nonprofit organizations, conservation organizations. They're dedicated to habitat and wildlife and recruitment of youth to keep the process going and get more folks and attention brought to conservation efforts and habitat and wildlife. Very noble cause. Unfortunately, when we got together with the CEOs of the five organizations, there was way too much ego in the room to make everybody work. And organizations that were headquartered, like mine, in the east and south, don't understand the west. And they kind of take for granted what goes on back there in these huge conventions, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania being one, and the money raised. But a lot of that money just goes in private companies' pockets. And ISE show comes to Salt Lake every year. We used to participate in that. None of that money stays here in this state, so, except whatever they have raised in sales tax. So it's unfortunately dwindled down to two primary organizations that are doing a great job. I especially like the youth involvement, particularly when they transport inner-city youth who wouldn't be exposed to any outdoor experiences of wildlife, bring them in and have activities and education programs for them. And these are several hundred that they bus into that. Also, this is the National Archery in the Schools program, which is a tremendous program for benefiting school kids and introducing them to outdoor activities and potential hunting activities, although the emphasis is not on hunting. Kids that are involved in that program do better in school. They have fewer problems. They have higher grade point averages. Started in Kentucky, and it's huge, and this is the finals that they have at that expo. And it's been a tremendous success. So the small amount of money that comes in through that application fee, I think, is going for a worthy cause, a very worthy cause. And I've seen it and participated in it for the last 9 years or 8 years, and I would recommend that we continue forward. I do think that they need that extension to give them time to reserve space and work around dates of other competing conventions and national meetings that occur about the same time. January and February are a busy time, and you have to get those dates locked up in way in advance to be able to bring the public in.
Additional comments? Jim?
Well, I haven't heard anybody say anything bad about the Expo. I don't see that this is an attack on the Expo or on how it's been run. I think everybody's pretty satisfied with the fact that it's a good thing. Everybody that stood up likes it, and I think most of us like it. I think the question is, in my mind, the $3.50 and what that actually amounts to, and what exactly that goes to. Now, everybody knows that nonprofits are a convenient title, but don't describe the way the organization works. And they may be nonprofits for tax purposes, but people are allowed to make money, and oftentimes in nonprofits they make a lot of money. And I'm not here to criticize any organization at the moment, but I'd like to know $3.50 times what? How many applications do they get?
The average the last few years has been just under $1 million total.
Total?
Yes.
So they'd get 70% of that, or $700,000?
Correct.
Roughly?
Yep. Ballpark.
And if that were reversed, they'd get $300,000?
Yep.
But if it all goes to conservation work and all goes to improving habitat and improving wildlife, then if it comes to the division directly or if it comes through their projects, then the division still benefits the same. If it was precluded with the word if. Am I right?
Yeah, I would think so.
Depending on who's the more efficient in using the money.
Correct. We don't run the convention, so.
No.
Yeah.
I understand that, but I'm saying if we were to accept the recommendation of the Wildlife Cooperative, then we would cut their funding by $400,000. But that would go to projects because you would get it directly, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Jeffrey.
I want to comment on the on the five-year extension. It just seems to me, and I come from an industry where we're always bidding on jobs, and every once in a while, more than every once in a while, people get sweetheart deals and we don't even get to bid on it, even though we would do a better job. And I think it doesn't seem fair to not put something out to bid. If somebody thinks they can do a better job, give them a shot at it. If they know they have 5 years to do it, they better get started 3 years earlier to be prepared for it. And it's like going against an incumbent congressman. He's got the money already. He's got the infrastructure. He's going to probably win. But wouldn't it be sad if there wasn't somebody that had an opportunity to at least stand up and say, I can do a better job at that? I just hate to see us not give that opportunity to some organization that think they can do better. And they're doing a great job now, and they probably will continue. And I hope they do. But you know what I'm saying? I'd hate to see it not give them somebody the opportunity to say, I can do it better, and I need it to go out to bid to show it.
Bryce?
But I think they do in 2 years. If I'm your, what you stated in 2016, anybody can bid on it, right?
Correct.
So the other organization that came, I mean, if they want to try to bid on it, I mean, I guess everybody has a chance in 2 years. So, you know, and like he stated, you know, if he would hopefully agree that they get a chance, you know, if they did get the bid in 2 years, someone else,
that they had the chance to do it just because of the massive undertaking. So, and I just want to second how cool it is. I mean, kind of take it for granted how something that massive and that you know, meaningful to the hunting industry is right here in our backyard. We don't have to go to Reno or Vegas to see that every year because, you know, we have that same thing right here in Salt Lake. So I think it's a great thing they have. So I support it and second everything that John said.
Jim?
So at what point would the decision be made to extend? Would that be in the fifth year, fourth year?
That's a good question. I want to say the timeline I read was in May.
Kenny? Yeah, there you go.
Was in, sorry. It's far away from the podium. Let me look at the rule really quick and just make sure I'm not speaking out of school. But I want to say that the time frame was May of the year it expired.
The year it expired.
Paul, do you want to comment while he's looking that up?
Yeah, having been involved in, say, a large convention here in Salt Lake at the Salt Palace, it does take a lot of prep time and scheduling time ahead of time to know that that's coming at you and that that's set so you can get those orchestrated. So I really see, you know, if they've done a good job for 5 years and it does come up for rebid here in 2 years, though it seems like it's a little tight if it comes up for rebid in May and you're expecting to put on this kind of an activity in February, it's questionable whether or not that gives you enough time to even put it on. But to me, I can see the value of allowing that extension if they've done a good job for the 5 years and not go through the re-advertisement, the re-evaluation, to kick that back in play. And I guess the one question that I haven't heard a good answer to is if we see a flip in the percentages, does that convention or the expo go to another state because it's more favorable in another state? And I guess that would be my only concern, but I really have not heard anything. I understand that all states in a conservation pool, whether with the division or Sportsman's for Fish and Wildlife, but at what point do you hit the percentage point where that walks to another state? So
I found it. It was not me. It is the application between August 1st and September 1st of the year preceding the expiration of each one of those.
Okay.
About a year and a half.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm a little more comfortable with that.
Additional comments? Chris?
Kenny, I'm still stuck on the $3.50. We've talked about that being public funds because, of course, they are gained in the application for public permits. What I haven't heard is the audit process that ensures that the conservation organization is expending those public funds in appropriate manner, and the division is aware of those manners and has levied the control. In the rule that we are in the process of updating, which is Rule 55-2, it talks about the exposition audit means an annual review of multiple things. New language in this particular item, which is Item D, says the revenue generated from expo permit application fees and the expenditures of designated expo permit application fee revenue on division approved projects. Based on the way this information is highlighted, that's new language in the rule. Have we not audited that portion of the conservation organization's fees in the past? Are we just starting this? Do you have a history of audit sheets to show that we've done this in the past?
We began auditing in 2013, yes. But we don't, the way it's written, the $3.50 is available for the contractor to use for their overhead expenses. We don't look at that. The $1.50 that's left over, the additional, it was more like it was higher than that last year, but the additional stuff that's approved for projects, that's the stuff we make sure the funding that is used for division approved projects. Those are the funds we make sure they're separate. But we don't itemize the $3.50. We do itemize the $1.50 and make sure the projects are pre-approved by the division.
So the convention is 9 years old. 7 years into it, we started auditing. This year, we're writing the language into the rule to formalize that the audit must be done on the funds.
Correct. It was part of the amendment from 2012.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
So that was amended in the contract between you and the contractor.
Right.
But it wasn't part of the rule at the time.
Right.
And then as far as the funds being public funds, that's just an opinion of one of the presenters. Is that correct? The $350 is that it's actually public funds would be subject to interpretation by your legal staff, would it not?
I think that's fair to say.
Jim, then we'll get you.
So in actuality, the $700,000 that they, as a number that we tossed out, they can spend any way they want. They don't have to spend the nickel of that on wildlife projects. Is that correct?
It's for overhead, yes.
Okay. Jeffrey.
I know I might have missed this in the question section. So let's say the contractor gets another five-year extension. Can that go on in perpetuity? Can they get another five after that? And if not, that means they're out and they're done? I mean, you got to kick them to the curb after that?
I'll start with the second half first. That's entirely possible. It's performance-based, and if they don't meet any of those stipulations, they could be out, yes. The first part, no. It's a one-time five-year extension.
Okay.
Won't exceed 10.
And then there'll be an RFP for a new five-year contract, which could be extended an additional 5 years if this language is adopted.
Yeah. Yeah, I missed. I realized that. That was my mistake. Sorry about that. But I do just want to comment that, you don't get a chance to do it. I mean, it's stacked. Without giving them a couple years notice and an opportunity to bid, no one can ever beat the incumbent. You can never. It's stacked against them forever and always.
But if they're in that arena, they're probably already preparing.
They should be.
Yeah.
Additional comments and or a motion? Bryce?
Make a motion. We accept the proposal as presented.
Second.
We have a motion from Bryce Thurgood and a second from John Leonard to recommend the Wildlife Board approve R657-55 convention permit rule amendments as presented. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, a call for a vote. All in favor, please raise your hand. Say aye.
Aye.
9 in favor. Opposed? 3. Would one of you care to state your opposition for the Wildlife Board?
I don't presume to speak for Jeff, but my opposition is simply that I think the amount that goes to the organizer ought to be 30%, and the amount that goes to the DWR ought to be 70%. I'm not necessarily opposed, although I'm not real pleased with the five-year extension, but I'm not opposed to it.
Yeah, that's not me. I'm glad you didn't speak for me, Jim. I don't want to deny anybody a chance to make some money. So I'm okay with that part, but I'm not okay with not getting it going out for bid.
You know, Jeff, the original contractor was the Wild Sheep Organization, and then they decided to leave, and it was picked up by someone else. So it's happened.
Yeah.
One last thing I did. I was a little rushed on my Wildlife Board update. The Wildlife Board did not approve the no hunting of or no harvesting of collared bighorn sheep in Unit 8. but Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife did commit to provide some money to collar additional animals, and then the division is already planning on collaring, I think, 20 additional sheep outside the wilderness area this year. Is that correct, Paul? So, hopefully we will get some sheep collared that will be traveling back and forth that will be good for that study. So, motion to adjourn. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming to the meeting.